kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual, Cole, how are you doing?
Joe, I'm tired. I'm tired, Joe. I just want to crawl in a hole and die.
You sound good. You sound healthy.
Yeah, I'm doing great. Everything's fine.
Homeschooling doing well?
Well, the problem is that the kids that are in person have gone back now. And, like, it's just... everything we've spent the last month getting in the routine of is just shit the bed.
Nice. Well, we're about to shit the bed a little bit more because we have a guest joining us this week. How's that for a segue, Cole?
That was a very poor segue. I apologize to the guest.
AJ Grant Scrutton of Delala Studios. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm good. I thought that was a magnificent segue. Some might say it's the best I've had in my career.
Courage, Hill. I've spent, 4 or 5 years on this show tearing Joe down? Don't build him up.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have time for that. There's no praise.
No, none.
None. Zero. There's a fly in my house, but no praise. Goddamn flies. So, you're from Delala Studios. Your recent game, Battletoads, you're here to chat about that at least a little bit, and then I'm sure we'll stray off into God knows what else. But for the people who don't know what Battletoads is, give us the sales pitch.
Yeah, sure. It's going to be a very unsales pitchy sales pitch. But so Battletoads is a sequel to a franchise that was around when I was a kid. So the original Battletoads came out in 1991 for the NES. And the last Battletoads game before ours was 1994. So this is literally kind of 26 years later. I've got to make a sequel to one of my all-time favorite games. And we reflect that in the game. So the gameplay actually takes place 26 years after the last time we've seen the Toads. Things are a little bit different. So the game's available on Xbox, Win 10 Steam, and it's a big genre mashup. So there's kind of your classic side-scrolling action brawler gameplay in there. There's space shooter influenced by games like Geometry Wars and stuff. There's a random level where you're bobsledding on the back of an unconscious diplomat. There's about 11 kind of different game modes you'll kind of come across in the story. And it's all just about fun, you know. It's available to pick up on Game Pass, and kind of the way we see it, we kind of refer to it as like a popcorn game. You know, you're not going to spend 30 hours with this game, but, you know, you're going to get in there, you're going to play it for, you know, somewhere between, you know, 4 to 8 hours and have a really good time.
And sometimes that's all you need with games. Not every game needs to be a 60-hour JRPG epic.
No, exactly. You know, and there's a time and place for those games, right? Like, you know, once the project was finished, it was great for me. I could jump into some longer games I hadn't had a chance to finish, you know, like God of War, finally picked up Last of Us 2. But, you know, when I'm working on the projects, or when kind of I'm just not really able to give myself 70 hours in a game, having these kind of shorter experiences that you can kind of pick up and play and come back to as and when are fantastic, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the majority of my gaming, honestly, is like stuff that I can only put 2 or 3 hours into and be done with.
And that's great. Like, I think it's
sometimes 15 minutes. I have a short attention span these days.
Yeah, this is a world of short attention spans anymore. People firing up their phones during load screens.
I've done it.
Yeah, I'd be lying if I said I hadn't done it myself.
Hey, some of these games, those load times, like fire up Red Dead Redemption 2. That's a hefty load screen.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, I absolutely adore Final Fantasy 15. And when I got kind of 50-odd hours into that game, I'd often set the, you know, the auto traversal in the car to go from one end of the island to the other, and then go on my phone and check my messages while the car was driving.
And playing music, right?
Exactly.
Got to play those tunes in the car.
Got it. It's essential.
So let's stray off the topic right away. Final Fantasy 16. What are your thoughts on this?
You know, you put Final Fantasy on it, then I'm going to be excited to play it. you know, it's typical kind of at this stage, it's hard to really tell where it's going to sit in terms of Final Fantasy gameplay compared to the others. But, you know, I'm excited to give it a go. Like, I absolutely adored 15, like, absolutely adored it. You know, I think 15 was the first time I think I went into that game going, oh, I really don't enjoy open world games. And since then, like, it really pushed me towards stuff like The Witcher 3 and a lot more bigger games. So, like, I'm stoked on it. How about you guys?
Cole's not very excited because she's not a PlayStation fan.
Yeah, I zoned the fuck out over here. I was like, this is PlayStation.
I'm excited for it. I am disappointed that it's going to be at least a year exclusive on PlayStation. I prefer playing on Xbox, but
it's coming to PC though, isn't it?
I don't know what their official stance is. I don't remember.
I think they actually came out recently, didn't they? And said that they're not sure they're going to be doing PC or not at this stage.
I'm not sure. I know Demon's Souls, there was confusion with that one as well, whether that would be on PC, and they came out and confirmed that one will not be on PC.
Oh, so, maybe it was that.
Yeah, it's too many games, too many platforms. I'm not a fan of exclusivity when it comes to third-party stuff. But Battletoads is a first-party property, so exclusivity makes sense there.
That was a fantastic both segue and recovery.
Yeah, bring it back full circle to Battletoads.
For that.
How did Delala get the license to Battletoads? How did this all come together?
Yeah, so it's interesting, really. So kind of, like, we've had a great relationship with Microsoft and Rare over the years. So, like, in terms of Microsoft, we were, like, the first ever internally incubated studio by Microsoft, like, 6 months after we formed in 2012. And then kind of we parted ways for a while. And then we helped out our friends at Rare with Sea of Thieves about in the last 6 months of that project cycle. But really, kind of since 2012, I've been pitching for Battletoads. Like, I've been pitching to do a Battletoads game. And the first few pitches I did were some of the worst concepts you could ever see. Like, honestly, like, all I can say is you have to trust that Craig Duncan that runs Rare does not just sign up any pitch he gets, because if he had, we probably would have had a Battletoads game about 5 years ago that would have been absolute trash. but we really kind of what the Battletoads you're seeing now, we started pitching it around 2016, and we were working directly with Rare on a pitch, trying to find a concept we both liked. Kind of we got them excited, and then, you know, the industry was in a weird place, trying to find the kind of right structure, and really kind of Game Pass coming out and doing what it did. Game Pass kind of suddenly gave us an avenue to kind of get this game done. Kind of like in 2018, the conversation came back around, and suddenly, you know, it went from being this kind of, oh, wouldn't it be awesome if we did this, to actually being, you know, let's do this. Let's kind of get going.
Let's make it happen.
Exactly. Yeah. All, you know, it's still super surreal now, but, you know, the amazing thing for me isn't just the fact we got to work on this game or work with Rare. Like, it's the fact that, like, this is our game, this is our concept. Do you know what I mean? Like, this wasn't like Rare coming to us and saying, make this game. This was really like, this was the game Delala wanted to make. And I never really thought that would be a possibility.
So Microsoft and Rare were pretty much hands off with this and were like, do what you want to do, have fun, just make it a good game.
Yeah, so, you know, with Rare, like, we had two guys who were on the project. Like, we had Paul Collins, who was kind of like our creative liaison at Rare. And then we had Paul Cunningham, who was, you know, I think his official role is like external relationships manager, but he was really kind of like our external producer. So we spoke to them every day. They'd give us feedback on what we were doing. You know, Paul Collins would be involved in some kind of like the creative brainstorms and bouncing ideas off of. But Rare and Microsoft really let us make the game we wanted to make, and they did everything they could to just support us in making that. You know, I told the team every day, and I still tell the team now, like, you know, deals like this don't come around often. You know, I've been in games about 15 years. You know, I've been running Delala for 8 of them, and, you know, I still don't fully believe how this happened, to be honest.
It's really cool. I remember talking, I don't know if it was you I talked with a couple of years ago about Overruled, but I know we covered Overruled on the show way back when, and I was really psyched to see your studio taking on Battletoads, because I really like the art style of Overruled, and to see what you guys could do with Battletoads, I thought it came out really well, especially just the mash of all the different genres in the game.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, Overawed was amazing for us. Like, you know, Overawed was, we were the five guys in the garage. We'd kind of gone from being in this lovely internal incubation in a fancy Soho office in London to kind of going back, having no money. And, you know, the HQ was my parents' garage. and kind of looking back on it now, it's crazy. And, you know, the amount of money we made Overawed for, like, that's about how much the studio costs a month nowadays. So it's, you know, it feels like a lot has happened since then, but it wouldn't, you know, Battletoads wouldn't have happened without Overawed. Like, Overawed kind of put us in a place we needed to be. It helped us kind of grow as the studio. I mean, including me, out of the six people really that worked on Overawed, you know, one of the artists from Overawed is Grant, who's lead designer on Battletoads. Two of the programmers, Chris and Ben. Ben's my tech director now. Chris is a senior programmer. They've all been with me nearly 8 years. So there's a lot of that kind of, that Overawed blood is still pumping through the company now and what you see in Battletoads.
How big has the company grown over the years?
Too big. No, I think...
There's too many of you sons of bitches here. Go away.
It's exactly that. Exactly that. I think as of today, because we had one of our contractors return as a full-time member, I think we're officially 23 or 24 full-time. And that's kind of, well, we normally all be based out of our offices in Essex. It's just me at the moment here at the office. But yeah, 23 or 24 of us full-time. But on Battletoads, kind of, we went up to 60 plus at one point, including our partners, which was terrifying. I mean, 23 is terrifying, don't get me wrong. So
I have what, like 80 you guys working for me, Cole? Something like that?
Yeah, some days it feels like more. Sometimes we'll do a show and you're like, this many people are joining us. And I'm like, Joe, you remember I have social anxiety, right? I have to keep a bucket under the desk for anxiety puke, Joe.
Oh, come on. They're all people that are on the show regularly. You know that.
Anxiety does not give a fuck.
I know. I'm the same exact way. Yet we keep having guests on. Go figure, huh?
It's nice to have somebody else to talk. Blah!
You know, that's the great thing about anxiety, right? You can have lots of different people causing it, and at least you've got a story to go with each bucket of puke, you've got a different story to go with it.
Every bucket's a story to tell. Oh my god.
Segue from that, bitch.
I'm fucking trying. That's a tough one to get off of. Well, puke is gross. Battletoads is known for being gross with rash, zits, pimple. What kind of crazy off-brand humor did you guys dive into with Battletoads?
That was a fantastic segue. You did well there. yeah, so kind of like the humor's kind of split. Like, we didn't go quite as like explicitly gross out as like Battletoads Arcade did, which obviously was a little bit more gory. You know, it had moves like, you know, grabbing an enemy by the balls and punching them. We went a little bit more stupid in a lot of ways, and that was very deliberate. So kind of in terms of like the writing and like the story, we had an incredible writing team. So like Tom, our lead writer, was one of the main writers on Rick and Morty for the first three seasons.
Oh, wow.
And then Kelsey and Wade, who worked with Tom, like both of those have kind of got lots of cartoon experience writing for like Cartoon Network and people like that. And so kind of that kind of irreverent, kind of eccentric cartoon humor was really important. And then kind of animation wise, we, you know, Eric, who's our animation director, like his first role in games was cleaning up the pencil test line work on Earthworm Jim 1 and 2. So kind of, you can see a lot of that kind of going through the game and a lot of Tex Avery and Looney Tunes influence in kind of, you know, the big over the top poses, the eyes popping out. So really we're just, you know, I mean, the professional answer is, you know, we took a mishmash of kind of different components and put it together. But the reality is I just got, you know, given an incredible, you know, I've got an incredible team and I got given money to just put loads of my favorite things into a single game. And that's what I did. I took some of my favorite writers, my favorite animators, and I got, you know, to make the game of my dreams, basically.
That is awesome. It's cool when you get to talk to a developer and they're just this excited about a game because it's something that they've wanted to do. Just passion projects make me happy.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's an incredible job. Like, you know, I often say, so I've got the best job in the world. Sometimes it's a horrible industry at times, but like, you know, I've been doing, you know, I've been running Dalala now for, it was 8 years in June, and every single day I've gotten up and I've looked forward to going to work. And, you know, 90% of that has been because of this team I've got, and this, you know, it's an unreal, you know, it's just an unbelievable team in terms of everyone is so passionate. Everyone wants the studio to do well, the projects to do well. I spend literally zero time dealing with office politics. And then the other 10%, which is still a big 10%, is because I get to work on projects like Battletoads. Like, literally, you know, I had friends messaging me, you know, over the last couple of weeks since we released. And like, one of them was like, dude, I met you 6 years ago and you said to me your dream was to one day do Battletoads in the style of Cartoon Network. How many people get to say they've done their dream? And I was like, yeah, like, I you know, I know how goddamn lucky I am, especially like, you know, the state the world's in. I know how lucky I am to be doing this and working on the stuff I'm working on.
Speaking of the state of the world, was there any concern with releasing a game that was local multiplayer only during quarantine?
Yeah, look, it's hard. And, look, I'm not press trained. I haven't been given a script on this stuff. So kind of what you're getting here is just kind of the raw, honest truth. The game, you know, we started working on this game in 2018. You know, we really started working on it probably only a few days before people saw the teaser at E3 in 2018. And one of the goals we set early on was, you know, couch co-op. You know, we knew we wanted to recapture the feeling that we had when we were kids. We knew to do that, we wanted a couch co-op experience. Based on the scope of what we're trying to achieve, that allowed us to really execute the game we wanted to make. And also, it then influences decisions, right? We knew we could make the game a little bit more trolly, because if somebody was winding you up, you could slap them because they were sitting next to you. but like, you know, it's very easy in hindsight now. Like, if we'd known 2 years ago that the world would be in the state it was in, of course we would have probably looked at making a different game. We would have looked to make, you know, an online experience and change the speed of the game and some of the game modes. But we didn't. And we had this game that we were super proud of. We had this amazing platform in Games Pass. And, you know, what we didn't want to do is we didn't want to have this game and finish this game and have it all ready to go and then just hold on to it because of fear of, you know, We never want to look insensitive, right? Like, we're not sitting here going, break the rules, ignore lockdown, go play it on couch co-op. But what we have seen is that suddenly this game that I pictured in my head the days when I was a kid, you know, I played Battletoads Double Dragon with my cousin Jamie. Like, in my head, that's what I pictured. Oh, you know, friends coming together. Suddenly we released this game out to the world and we started getting pictures of families playing. And it was amazing because I'd never seen this as a family game. Like, I'd never thought, you know, oh, family. But I never thought I'd be getting pictures of like a dad playing with his daughter and son, or like brothers and sisters playing together. And whilst I know online co-op would have been great for lots of friends who can't be together right now, I also really am grateful because I wonder how many family members ended up playing a game together that don't normally play together because of the situation. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, gaming has exploded with this pandemic going on. It seems, you know, movies are failing, TV is kind of failing, but video games have boomed. And it's cool to see games like this that allow families to actually do something together for once.
Yeah. It's just awesome, right? Like, it is great. Like, it makes me feel like, you know, I remember when I was a kid and me and my dad would play Top Gun on the NES, you know, and we were awful. We never got past the first level because if anyone has ever says they successfully ever refueled their plane, they're liars. Like, we never got past that. But I've got great memories of that. And I've got memories of like my mum playing Columns on the Mega Drive. And this is an awful time right now. And there's a lot of awful stuff going on. But even if there's one kid, one parent that suddenly got this memory that during this awful time, they remember playing that stupid game with their son or their daughter where they were, you know, on the back of a diplomat bobsledding through a strange level. Like, if somebody in 20 years time, 26 years time is talking on a podcast like yourselves, maybe it's even your podcast, right? You're still going, you're still throwing
don't,
up in the bucket.
Don't yeah, put that on me. Don't put time. That evil on me. I don't want to be here in 26 years.
Maybe you're talking to someone in 26 years who's made the next entry into the Battletoads franchise and they're telling you about, you know, when they experienced this game with their parents or their brothers and sisters. And, like, for me, like, that's it's something I never thought of and something that's felt amazing. And, you know, it's very easy to focus on the negative when you read the internet. Like, you know, I always tell the team, like, look, I'll post the positive reviews into the Slack channels because for me, I'll read 15, 8, 9s out of 10s. And then I'll read one 4 out of 10 review. And all I think about is that 4 out of 10, right? But and normally nothing cuts through that negativity, but pictures of families playing together going, oh, we love playing Battletoads. Like, that cuts through the negativity every time for me.
No, I'll tell you now, if I'm doing the show in 26 years and we bring someone on to talk about Battletoads 2 in 26 years, you're coming on too. I'm dragging you back on.
I mean, look, by that point, I hope that I'm just riding around in a solid gold Hummer and I'm just way too busy to talk to podcasts. By then, I've got, you know, 4 layers of assistants who talk on the podcasts for me. That's, you know, but that's why we all.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, man. So, Cole, what kind of questions do you have about the game? I feel like I'm asking everything.
I had one as I was sitting here, and then, like, we started talking about the Gold Hummer, and I started thinking about Gold Robots, and it just went out the window. I lost it. It'll come to me in a second. I was also thinking about how he kept mentioning brothers and sisters and sons and daughters playing, and, like, my 3 girls have actually played the game together.
Oh, that's awesome.
That is, they gathered around in their oldest sister's room, gathered around the Xbox, just playing Battletoads.
That's brilliant. And, like, that's so awesome for me. Like I said, we didn't sit down and go, we're making a family game. Like, we never said we're going to make a game families won't enjoy, but it was never a target. And then it became like this surprise, super rewarding thing where suddenly people shared the pictures and we're like, oh my God, like, this is an audience we never thought of, but how awesome is this?
No.
We're all kind of locked in with our multiplayer partners, whether we like it or not at this point.
Yeah.
Carnage. Go ahead.
I was going to say, Carnage is asking in chat. He's been asking for a while. Is online out of the question for Battletoads, or is there still a chance it might come in the future?
Look, it's not my place to answer that question. But all I can tell you is that Delala aren't currently working on it. We're not currently working on an online for Battletoads. There is a lot of work that goes into adding online into a game, even at the start. And I just, for me personally, like, if we tried to put online into it now, I'd be very, very concerned about the quality of the experience because of lag. And, you know, especially with some of the cooperative game modes, like the space shooter and stuff like that, they'd really, if you lost the twitchiness because they had to be slowed down because of lag. It's like I said, like, it's not our game. Like, obviously, it's a Rare and Microsoft game. But for me, like, I think if we were going to do online and we knew it from the start, we would have made a lot of different choices when we made the game, including very much like the speed of gameplay. I can't say it'll never be there. I can't say it ever will be there. All I can tell you is we're not working on it at the moment.
Fair enough. Cole, what were you going to ask before Carnage interrupted you because he's good at that?
The original Battletoads was deemed one of the most difficult games ever. Was there any special challenges you faced in a climate where accessibility is more important in developing a game, where you had to balance accessibility with difficulty?
Great question.
Every time I get great question, I know I asked a hard one.
Look, we were way off the mark with where we thought the difficulty was. I don't repeat what I've said on another podcast, not to tell you that I've been cheating on you with another podcast.
It's okay. We deserve it.
But, you know, if we were looking at the difficulty on a scale of 1 to 10, we genuinely believed that our middle difficulty, Toad, we genuinely believed we were like a 5 or 6. When the game came out, it became apparent to us that we're probably more of like an 8 out of 10. So, like, we actually, the game's a lot harder than we thought it was. I think part of that is because of everything that happened. We played it free player a lot less before launch because obviously we'd gone into lockdown during the last few months. It also meant kind of, you know, where we'd normally do those last bits of user testing and kind of get feedback, like, that kind of went out the window. We genuinely didn't think we were making a game anywhere near as hard as I think we've made. we wanted to make something fun that, you know, had three levels of difficulty. Toad being like, oh, this is how we designed it. Battletoad being, we've upped the challenges to the point where only a few of us in the studio can defeat it. And then Tadpole was very much like, you know what, like, we still want you to get the experience of completing the game, but, you know, it's definitely a lot easier. Like, To the Queen, which is the first Turbo Tunnel level, we took out loads of the hazards in that, in Tadpole. And that was kind of an approach we took of, like, reducing the risk, making you more powerful. So I'd like to think that, Tadpole was a lot more accessible from a difficulty perspective. But, you know, in terms of, like, accessibility as a whole, I think the game's quite hard on that sense. You know, there is a lot of Twitch play. There is a lot of reliance on kind of dexterity because of, like, you know, we've got the emergency stations, which is that ridiculous space mini game where you've got to rotate sticks and kind of hammer buttons. So, yeah, it's hard. Like, the game overall is a lot harder than we realized it was. We tried to make something easier than we actually did, and we didn't realize it until everyone was playing it. So, yeah, like, I think in hindsight, there's probably stuff we would have made easier knowing it now. Like, there's definitely, like, levels I look at and I can see there's people getting stuck on there, and I think to myself, oh, I wish we'd done this. I wish we'd done that. But I don't think there's probably many people that make any game, release it, and then don't sit there and go, oh, damn it, I wish we'd done this.
Time for a patch.
But yeah, to answer your question after 2 hours of answering something different, yeah. It's,
Welcome to our show. That fits the MO.
It's a super interesting one to balance, and I feel we did a good job of doing what we thought we were doing in our heads, and it just turned out that what we thought we were doing in our heads wasn't actually what we had done. So we would have probably made it easier if we'd known that now.
I assume the, like, hardcore old school fans of Battletoads were probably okay with that difficulty, though.
Yeah, I imagine so. I think especially Battletoad, like, that was the one we tried to give those old school fans kind of a much more difficult challenge. You know, we didn't make this game to cater to, like, any specific audience. Like, we weren't trying to make something which was purely based at a nostalgia audience, because it's very hard to tell how much of that audience did exist. You know, a lot of that audience is probably like me, you know, 36 years old and older, and might not have the time to put into games like they used to. So we didn't want to make a game that was just for an older audience. So really kind of our goal was to kind of create a new audience, was to almost replicate the feeling we had as kids for a new kind of generation of gameplay, and then give difficulty levels that may be tailored a little bit more to those old school players.
Well, I'm definitely happy that Tadpole is there, because that's what my bitch ass plays on.
Yeah, same.
I think I played it on Tadpole way more at the end of our development cycle than I was on anything else.
Yeah, you mentioned the difficulty. It seems like that's a common thread when we have developers on, is that they just don't seem to realize how difficult the game is near the end because they've gotten so used to playing it. Do you think that's just what happened and why Battletoads is harder than you thought it was?
100%. And what makes it worse is that Craig, the studio head at Rare, would repeatedly say to me on a weekly basis, make it a bit easier. You're too close to it. You don't realize. And I'd go away and I'd be like, nah, I'm not too close to it. I can, you know, I can be neutral. You know, and then I watch people failing, you know, 10,000 times on Mistreated. And I'm like, oh, God damn it, Craig was right. yeah, it's really hard, you know, and it's especially hard because we didn't get to take it to shows. Like, you know, we took it out in 2019, but that build we took to E3 was like 3 months of production work. That was next to nothing. And then we were so focused on completing the game that, you know, when the game went to Gamescom in August of that same year, that was just the E3 build, and I changed the text for the joke at the beginning that referenced E3 to reference Gamescom. So we never really saw anyone playing the game that we were going to release with the balance we were going to release it as until the game was out there. But yeah, I think it's just so easy to do. Like, as designers and as developers overall, you're always, you know, I'm drilling into the team, you know, make sure you play it like a new player. All those shortcuts, don't take those because you wouldn't know those. Like, take it slow. You're discovering stuff for the first time. And I preached this day after day for 2 years. And even I was too close and I didn't realize it, right? So I just think it's so easy to do, especially when you're making a game like we were that we actually enjoyed playing. because we were just playing it and playing it and playing it. And, you know, in the last, well, I guess it would have been the last 2 months, every time we did a new build that was a potential release candidate, me, Ben, our technical director, and Mark, our IT director, we'd play the game start to finish just to make sure it worked. So every time we did a new build, we'd play the whole game start to finish. So by the end of it, we could play it with our eyes closed, and that definitely skewed, like, you know, that definitely skewed what we thought the difficulty was.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wish I was that good at the game, damn.
I'm not now. I'm definitely not now. Got bumped off from playing it, and now I'm awful.
Now, Carnage is saying, what about that 3-player required co-op achievement, Live and Let Drive, and 3-player co-op, all be on the bikes together for 300 seconds? Any chance at changing that and making it easier?
I don't think we're allowed to change achievements. I don't think you can change an achievement once it's out there. And obviously, the hope is that once the lockdown and stuff's over, that hopefully you'll be able to play it. However, I do believe there's some very, very smart person on Twitter who figured out a great hack using 3 controllers and some chopsticks to get it on their own.
And blue tack, yeah.
So, that, you know, whilst obviously I would much rather everyone gets that achievement by playing the game together with somebody once, you know, the pandemic's over, if you've got chopsticks and 3 controllers and some blue tack, there is a hack out there you can do.
I just chalk it up to I'm never getting that achievement.
Yeah.
I can't teach the cats to play. They just refuse to learn.
I don't think I've got that achievement on my personal console yet, you know.
Well, what you do is you get you some chopsticks and some blue tack.
No, you got to get some friends. That's what you need to do. That's what I need to do.
It's
friends.
We don't do friends in 2020, Joe. And probably not 2021 either, from the way things are looking.
I'd say that.
Oh, God. The world sucks. Something that doesn't suck is the music in this game. Tell us about the music in Battletoads, because I love the soundtrack.
But these segues, you're like 6 for 6 on these segues. So
if there's anything I'm good at on this show, it's terrible segues.
I like to constantly challenge him by like driving the topic way out into left field just to see how hard he can turn it back.
I mean, you're doing it to help him be better, though, and you're helping him show off, right? Like, he's bringing it back every time, so, you know.
My goal here is not to improve anything for Joe.
Yeah, her goal is to just rein me the fuck in.
I'm the antagonist in this bench.
But yeah, music. I was trying to remember myself for a second there. I was thinking puke bucket.
My work here.
Tell us about the music in the puke bucket.
So all the music is Dave Housden. So Dave is a longtime kind of collaborator and friend. So like Dave actually did the music on Janksy, which was the game we made for no money in 8 weeks in 2012. And Dave's done awesome stuff, like he did the soundtrack. In fact, he got BAFTA nominated for Thomas Was Alone. He's done stuff like Cube 2. Dave's just awesome. So kind of, you know, when I got the email on the call saying that we were doing this, it was like a no-brainer. Like, I instantly called Dave and was like, look, we're going to do Battletoads. I want you to do it. And we're going to give you the whole soundtrack to do. It's not going to be like a collaborative thing. I want you to own this. And so then kind of, we kind of knew what we wanted straight away. Like when Dave said to me, like, okay, well, what's the vibe we're going for? I was like, well, if you play the originals, you can hear that like David Wise was going for like metal, but he had MIDI. So he couldn't really do like what Dave Wise did metal wise with MIDI is insane. Like it's so good and it feels like metal, but it's a bunch of MIDI instruments. So I said to Dave, like, look, I want us to go over the top hair metal. I think one of our hero tracks we chose as like an example was the Power Rangers theme song. Just because it's so over the top and it's just obviously got big guitar solos going the whole time, etc. So at that point, kind of it then became like a level by level thing where like Dave was checking out, kind of what gameplay we were doing, what feel we were going for. And it ended up that the soundtrack was just as, if not more eclectic than the actual game modes. Like, that soundtrack's got everything on there, from the you know, the 80s hair metal influence to pan pipes in the platforming levels to some weird sci-fi pieces to, you know, there's a level called Gut Reaction. And like, in fact, I sent you that track, right? That's like a really over the top, super heavy track for the rest of the game.
What? You didn't send me anything. What? No.
Oh, yeah. Oops. I mean, yeah.
Oh, I found that off Kazaa.
Kazaa, yeah, you got it off Kazaa.
LimeWire. Yeah,
be careful when you open it. It's not going to be what you thought it was if you got it there.
My computer's smoking. What the?
But yeah, so like, Dave had a real challenge. Well, I felt I was giving Dave a challenge, and he claims I did, but he just knocked it out of the park. And what I really love as well is that, like, I was very big on this, that I wanted the game to have its own identity. Like, I didn't want us to have to rely on the old game as a crutch. Like, I didn't want us to feel like, you know, we were trying to build off of what was there, and that's the only reason we're making this. And then it was actually Dave that turned around and was like, look, like, there's a few songs from the old games that I think a new kind of approach and a new composition would work really well on. So like, when you play the game, there's, I think, five of David Wise's tracks from Battlemaniacs, Battletoads Double Dragon, and the original Battletoads that Dave kind of did a, Dave Housed and our Dave did a new, like, a new arrangement on, and kind of re-recorded full instruments. And what I love about that is, like, that wasn't Rare saying to us, include old songs. That wasn't me as game director going, we need to lean on these old songs. It was Dave going, I've played this level and this song just feels perfect for it. Like, I think we should do this. And that was awesome to me, because, you know, this Dave could have just claimed the whole soundtrack, right? He could have done his own song for every level and that would have been fine, and he would just been him getting credit. But like, he felt that there was an expectation he wanted to live up to, but he just felt there were these old tracks that he loved that just worked really well in these levels. And so he pushed me, and he was the one saying, hey, let's take these old awesome songs and turn them into kind of new arrangements.
That's really cool. It sounds like the big theme with this game is just freedom. Everyone was free to do what they wanted to make this the best game possible.
That's exactly it. And that, you know, and Gemma, our production director, will tell you that that is definitely a double-edged sword. like, there was a lot of good that came from that. And creatively, like, I think it was incredible for us to be able to do that. And, you know, the flip side of that is sometimes that went too far. Sometimes we went, sometimes I'd go overboard, and sometimes, you know, I'd push us in the wrong direction and we'd have to pull it back. But, you know, we got to make a game where, like, we redesigned the characters. We got to tell the story we wanted to tell, put in 11 game mode, do the soundtrack we wanted to do. You know, we got to do everything we would have done on an original IP, except for we had this awesome Battletoad universe to play with and the support of one of the biggest platform holders in the world. And that's just amazing, really.
And it turned out really well, I think. Reviews have been all over the place. It seems people either love this game or they just weren't, it didn't click with them. What do you think the general consensus has been? Because you've seen all the reviews, I'm sure.
I have seen every single one of them. I've seen every review, every Twitter post for pretty much the first month I read that if it had the word Battletoads in it. yeah, I mean, it's like you said, like, we knew we were going to make something diversive. Like, we knew it was going to split the audience, especially like those purists who kind of really wanted, you know, something I've said a few times, I don't want to repeat myself too much, is like, when you talk about Battletoads, Battletoads means different things to different people. Like, when you talk to me about Battletoads, I instantly think of 1991 Battletoads and Battletoad Double Dragon. Whereas there's a big audience out there, you say Battletoads and they think about Battletoads Arcade. And what we made was more akin to 91 Battletoads than it was Arcade. So I think there was a lot of reviewers who went in expecting a sequel to Arcade that got this, you know, they wanted this brutal heavy metal aesthetic side-scrolling beat 'em up, and suddenly they got this stupid, silly cartoon where you've got a, you know, you go from a combat level to massaging an alien. like, they were just like, what the hell is this? But I mean, look, you know, Metacritic, I look at Metacritic and, you know, we're sitting on a 72, which I'm super proud of. Like, you know, anything above 70s is awesome. And like, most of those reviews on there, like 42 of them, I think, not to quote the actual numbers, but like 42 of them are positive reviews on there. So I think, like, overall, it's been really well received. But it's amazing to have a game where you can look at our two Metacritic pages and we've literally got 100 from one person, like 100 out of 100. And then we've got 40 from someone else. Like, I sat there for like, because they all, I think both those reviews came in within the first couple of days, and I sat there and I was like, how can this happen? Like, I knew we were going to have something that somebody loved and somebody would hate, but 140, like, this is actually insane.
That's a hell of a range.
It's ridiculous. But, you know, I told the team for the last 2 years, if you make something and no one hates it, then no one's going to love it, right? Those two emotions live so close to each other on a line that you're not going to be able to have one without the other. You don't get something somebody loves unless somebody else hates it. And we would much rather have a bunch of people that hate it and a bunch of people that love it than end up living in this, like, mediocrity where we're in the middle and people are just, like, indifferent to it. So obviously I would have preferred that everyone in the world loved it, but I'm just really, really happy that we've got some fantastic quotes. We're seeing these awesome tweets and just a lot of positivity out there.
And of course you got to come on our show.
I mean, what's better than that?
Like, lots of things, really. I mean, let's be fair.
I'm glad this came at this point because, you know, if I'd come on the show straight away, then, you know, nothing else would have compared to it over the last month and a half.
You got to live, and now you got to do our show, and now there's nothing else to accomplish in life. You're set.
You know, on my bucket list, it was, you know, make Battletoads do this podcast.
Yeah.
So, the only thing left is that gold hammer.
Yeah.
That's it.
Gold hammer.
That runs on fairy dust and pure platinum. That's what
I'm going. Cheap. Sounds cheap to run. Affordable. Good mileage, I'm sure. Hummers always get good mileage, right?
I mean, that's why you buy them. That's the number one reason for buying them.
Both the miles per gallon.
Suburb car.
Oh, man. Well, I know we've been chatting for quite a while. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't bring up?
No, I don't think so. Like, I think kind of we've covered a lot of bases. You know, I'm very, very grateful for everyone that's played it, everyone that's given their opinions, either good or bad. Like, it's awesome. Want to say thank you to kind of like the Discord community we've had, which has been not only incredible, but completely unbiased. You know, we've had people on our Discord, like, saying what they hate about the game as much as saying what they love, which is brilliant. And yeah, you know, I genuinely have loved making this game and genuinely love playing it. So kind of, if you've got no money and you've got Game Pass, please pick it up. You know, if you've got money but not enough, I'm sure it will hit sales eventually. You know, that's out of our hands, but I'm sure it will. And just, yeah, just know that, you know, we didn't go out of our way to make a game to deliberately upset people. We just went out there to make a game that felt true to what we wanted. And it's like, it's a Battletoads game made by a very, very, very big Battletoads fan. And that may be a different type of Battletoads fan to you, but it's still a Battletoads fan.
Yeah, I have a number of friends who've played it on Game Pass. So the fact that it's on Game Pass is awesome. We never hesitate to talk about how much we love Game Pass on this show. So,
yeah,
old,
I mean,
good old Game Pass.
Game Pass.
I mean, I love it. I mean, there's so many games on it that I've played that I wouldn't have played otherwise. You know, like, I never really touched the 2 to 3 hour more kind of artsy independent pieces. Like, they're not necessarily games I would have picked up, but I've ended up playing loads of them on Game Pass because, you know, it's almost like that mobile thing, right? Where you browse, you see something, and you're like, you know what? Why not? Let's go for it. So, yeah, I love it. As a consumer, I think it's great. And as a developer, it let me make Battletoads, so I will be eternally grateful to it.
Will your future projects be on Game Pass? What is next for Dalala?
That's a mighty fine question.
Robots are beeping outside the window.
Gold robots.
Yeah. I mean, I can't really speak about exactly what's next at the moment. But in terms of kind of like Game Pass, like, I would love to see our future titles we make end up on Game Pass. I just think it's fantastic. I just think it's really good for the industry as a whole. You know, and like I said, there's no bias. We're not owned by Microsoft. I've had my money from Microsoft to make a game, so I've got no kind of bias anymore. But like, I love it as a consumer. You know, I've got all three platforms at the moment. You know, I love, because there's games I love on all of them. But yeah, just for me, like, I just love that Game Pass model. I just think it's so good. I'd much rather drop, you know, the subscription money every month and get like hundreds of games to just play at my own leisure. So yeah, I really, really hope we see more Dalala titles on there in the future.
Same. I agree with you on that one. Paul, what do you think?
Everything should be on Game Pass.
God damn right. I love Game Pass.
Fucking everything. My backlog is gross.
That comes up so often in reviews that we do. It's like this game would have been great on Game Pass to have a built-in audience for multiplayer, mm-hmm. and so many games it feels like it's untapped potential, but the future will tell.
Yeah, well, that's it, right? Like, I mean, games get added onto there that have been out for a while and they suddenly find new audiences. And I mean, Ben, tech director, and Mark, IT director, they're also my two best mates. And we jumped into Destiny 2 for the first time. I've never played Destiny 1 or 2. And like, because it dropped in Game Pass over the weekend with all the DLC, like, we jumped into it and I ended up spending like 6 or 7 hours over the weekend. You know, and I never would have probably dropped full box price on it because it's one of those games where I'm not convinced I've got enough time to repeatedly try it. So that was wicked for me going into Game Pass. And like, I think that's awesome. Like, I think getting to engage with games that have been out a while that you might have missed is just brilliant.
Since you said you're checking out new artsy-fartsy indie games, may I introduce you to one of my most favorite ever that is currently in Game Pass?
Go on then. What's it called?
Night in the Woods.
Oh, yeah. So I started. I've got Night in the Woods.
I love Night in the Woods. I started
that before. I was talking to someone the other day. I'm going to go back to it. I spent a lot of time in it, and I got stuck on one level and really frustrated and stopped.
Would you believe me if I told you that there is legitimately an Excel spreadsheet for all the dialogue options?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's such a well-written game, and I love the little touches as well. Like, there's no real platforming in it, but they've got, like, the Mario 64 style flare and flourish where, like, you do the free jump in a row, and yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful, well-written game, and I was having a lot of fun with it until I got moody and old and stuck on it. but Game Pass now means I can play it on my TV and give it another go, so I probably will.
There you go. Something else that's beautiful, really quick. Mr. Sinister dropping 301 biddies in chat on Twitch. Mr. Sinister, thank you so much. Norg, take it away.
Drop it, bitch!
Oh, there's 13 more biddies, too. Oh, he's going to fill the cup. Thank you, Mr. Sinister.
Drop it, bitch!
On that note, I guess we could wrap this up. AJ, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Come back in the future. It's been great chatting with you.
I would love to come back at any point, and I'm sure there are plenty of my team members that would also love to come on and have a chat with you if you ever want them. So thank you very much for having me.
Give us a few weeks. We're kind of booked for the next month or so, but after that, yes, let's do something. Yeah, you are kicking off like a month straight of interviews for us. So
please send help.
Yeah, send help, and thank you for being here. Do you have everyone else? We're going to take a quick break. We're going to listen to some music. We'll be back with more show. We have a party cast coming up. Pernell and Chris will be here. We'll have reviews to take care of. AJ, do you have any final words to end the interview?
No, just thank you very much for having me. And if you can, everyone listening, please play Battletoads.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Another thanks to AJ at Dalala Studios for coming on and chatting with us. Cole, how fucking fun was that?
That was a good chat.
That was a good chat. We got to have him back. That was fun. Yes. And Battletoads is good stuff.
Get the whole crew in there. Maybe next time they can tell us what they're doing without golden robots banging on their door.
Maybe. But yeah, it's always good when at the end of an interview, they're like, yeah, I can't wait to come back and bring friends.
Yeah. I'm sorry for their friends, though.
Yeah, poor
people. They either think very highly of them that they think they'll have a good time, or they think very poorly of them that they just want to sacrifice them to the SML podcast.
Yeah, speaking of people who get sacrificed to the SML podcast, Chris and Purnell are both here. How are you two doing?
Well, I'm still looking for my soul. Thanks for stealing it.
You're otherwise, looking for your soul.
My bad.
It was sacrificed to the SML pocket.
That's where I got all these freckles from.
I don't know how souls are the result or what provide freckles on a person's face, but that's some interesting tech.
Have you not ever heard that? That gingers don't have a soul, but all the freckles are the souls they steal?
See, I heard the first part before, but never the second. But
it's hilarious because anytime, it takes a while for freckles to start to appear, right? And so, anytime we notice that number three has a new freckle, number one will be like, oh, she stole a soul last night.
There's that one kid who's in school now that's kind of, not quite their self anymore. We don't know what happened. Yesterday, she was doing fine. She was doing double dutch on the sidewalk, and then the next morning, she was just kind of drooling out of her nose.
Just because a little husk of who she used to be.
She's a shadow of her former self. What happened?
Aren't we all?
Yeah. 2020's been rough.
It has been.
2020 has been the longest decade of my life.
I wanted to be responsible and watch the debate, but I also wanted to drink because I needed
it. You don't want to watch that debate. I didn't watch it before we got started. You don't want to watch that shit.
Oh, I gave up so fast. It was not ridiculous. It was sad. It was sad.
This country's fucked.
This is stressing me out.
I will say this, though. I went in expecting a shit show, so it was nothing I didn't expect. So in that regard, there was a entertainment from it. It was like, if you already know it's coming, you just kind of just mock. Baby, mock. Like that guy.
The sheer amount of women posting drinking memes for the debate though tonight on my Facebook was hilarious. And
I'll drink.
We're an hour in. I bet you some of them people are fucking dead now.
Yeah.
the death count's about to skyrocket. No one saw this coming, and it's gonna be as a result of it was a way to go. I mean, it was a fun drinking contest, so I'm okay with this result. I'm okay with it.
Oh, goodness.
Because, and the thing about it is, I actually legitimately had fun coming up with, ridiculous reasons to drink, too. Every time you did a cocaine sniffle. Yeah,
that was one of them I saw.
Yeah, that was my go-to there. I'm like, yeah, sounds like a sniffle's coming. Every time he used, an insult, sleepy, or, basically, he would just use Garbage Pail Kid names.
Yeah,
that's his literal shtick. He says Garbage Pail Kid names, and I kind of chuckle at the idea because it runs on the pattern: Sleepy Joe or Creepy. I don't know, what's that? What do you call Schumer? Creepy Schumer, or Chuck Schumer, or something. And it was always something. I don't remember what it was,
but it was decidedly racist.
90% of what Trump says is racist.
It's racist.
So I ultimately just picture John Pound drawing all these people when he comes up with these dumb names. It's like, okay, Sleepy Joe might be, taking a nap and having nightmares of, a shithell of a country here. And also he's being stabbed in the eye with some kind of weird, Cabbage Patch Grim Reaper scythe thing or something. I don't know. Cause that's a Garbage Pail Kid. That's how it has to work. There has to be a twist. But yeah, all those, that's his whole thing. So, and it helps me deal with it. I just Garbage Pail Kid everything. And then of course I've been drinking red, white, and blueberry vodka. So
oh, God. That's where all
this insightful prattle's coming from, friends.
Parnell's drunk.
I'm not drunk. I'm light.
Go home, drunk your Parnell.
I'm already a drunk. You go drunk.
What'd you say, Chris?
That I got the big guns out. I'm drinking Dr. Pepper and cream soda.
Oh, me too.
I have a bottle of it next to me, but right now I'm drinking another Mountain Dew Violet.
I have one can open and I got another for backup in case my mouth gets dry.
He's laughing. He's like, I'm drinking Dr. Pepper and I'm drinking cream soda. I was like, you know, you could get Dr. Pepper cream soda too. It covers all the bases right there.
But that's the thing, though, is that I am drinking the Dr. Pepper cream soda, but it has an ampersand in it.
Oh.
So the ampersand. The world famous ampersand. Oh, shit. Trivium Champ is rating us with a party of 7. I feel so bad for all of you.
I do too. Because
this Trivium shit Champ has already jumped the shark.
Yes. I don't have a raid thing. Why don't I just play Wet Pancakes? George.
Wet Pancakes!
Raid. That works. Right, Parnell?
Fucking yeah!
Raid!
You're going to be relying on that Parnell soundbite tonight because he's not lucid enough to say anything on his own.
So tell us about that game you're playing, Parnell. Fuck yeah! Fuck yeah! Fuck yeah! Fuck yeah! Fuck yeah!
What do you think, Parnell? Like, is the game worth picking up?
Fucking yeah! Fuck yeah!
All right.
You have like different versions of it, like slowed down and sped up.
That's a very good slow down. I approve.
We have problems. We have lots of problems.
Yes, we do, and there's one cure for those problems.
Vodka.
No, I gave you the segue. It was right there for you, Joe. Right there.
Vodka. Yes, vodka.
You threw him the segue and he tripped over it.
No, I wasted all the good segues during the interview.
Look, that was a lot of effort there, and I was purposely trying to derail him.
Trying. I was all like, I can do this. I can get him on track. It's like, nope.
No, like, I did it twice on accident, and then I just had to step up my game and really make it go.
Oh, mercy.
Birmingham Champ saying, tell him to do Christopher Walken's and Joe Dirt. I love Joe Dirt. I love that movie.
I love Christopher Walken in it.
Yeah.
I like Dirt.
All right. Should we get to some reviews?
Fucking yeah.
Parnell, should we get to some reviews?
Fucking yeah! Why was I made to slow down?
Oh, God. We have a lot of games to talk about. Let's get to these. First game to talk about tonight is called Rebel Galaxy Outlaw, developed by Double Damage Games and Blitworks, published by Double Damage Games, released September 22nd on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $29.99. Out of cash, out of luck, out on the fringe, Juno Markley has a killer to tail, a debt to pay, and more troubled headed her way. Rebel Galaxy Outlaw takes place in a greasy blue-collar world of outlaws, truckers, cops, and thieves. Chris, they sound like your friends. Because we're all outlaws on this show.
Oh, I see.
And thieves and truckers. I think Parnell's a cop.
Oh. Oh, that's the worst one of all.
It's over.
So, Chris, tell us about Rebel Galaxy Outlaw.
Yeah, so I have first review this time, so I didn't have a chance to turn it on. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, God.
I was gonna start it during Parnell's review, but now it's not happening, so let's see what I can come up with. No, I really shouldn't say that stuff on the recording, should I?
No, you shouldn't.
It's too late now.
Okay, well...
I'm too lazy to delete it.
Rebel Galaxy Podcast Cops. This is about a lady who I've been trying to describe her for a while now, and I think I've got it. Well, for one, her voice sounds like Jane Lynch. That's an easy one. Like, she sounds exactly like her, and she looks like Nathan Fillion with the face of a Final Fantasy villain.
Okay.
So, oh no, not anime face.
It's not anime face. It's like, I'm like PlayStation villain.
Okay. Mm. Like, you saved it.
So yeah, the opening cinematic, actually the opening cinematic's kind of anime style, which is, you know, it becomes jarring when you're then losing it becomes coal again. Like, you know,
yeah, anime.
Well, like just the intro. And
done.
Then it switches into like the kind of more like realistic looking like character models and stuff like that. And it's, I don't know, it was jarring, but none of that matters. The character doesn't matter. In fact, her thing is basically that her husband got murdered. She's after the bad guy. There's a main quest to resolve that little issue. The real core of this game is that, so in doing so, she basically has a guy. She calls a guy. He looks like he's got an octopus for a beard. And he's like, okay, but you need a ship, so I'll give you this ship if you'll do this quest. And so she takes the ship. It is a piece of trash. It's like absolutely a clunker, which is great because I love a space game where you get to drive a clunker for the first part. And like then, of course, this mission for, you know, her free ship, it suddenly goes all sideways and she runs afoul of some space capitalists. So that's where the main quest kind of takes off. No pun intended.
Because it's a spaceship.
Yeah, this is a spaceship.
Son of a bitch.
So the real deal here is that, okay, so it's basically a space sim, but it has like all these different facets to it. People are like comparing it to Wing Commander, but I haven't played a Wing Commander since the one before the Super Nintendo one.
Oh, wow.
It was like Revenge of the Kilrathi, like from 1992 or one. And so, yeah, I don't know Wing Commander. but basically what it is that you go from little, like, you know, mining asteroids and planets and like all these places that have like, you know, civilization on them essentially. And when you're there, you can basically do a few different things. You can take on quests of certain kinds. Like either you can get into fights, which we'll talk about the fights in a minute. You can like deliver stuff. You can do like escort missions and, you know, whatnot. And basically you do all of this for money. And the money, of course, goes towards getting actual good ships and improving the like, which you're going to want to do because your junker starts off with like the worst gun in the world. So it's basically a Nerf dart gun. And so like that's one thing that you can do is you can do missions. You can start off, you can actually pay to join a mercenaries guild or a merchants guild, and they'll give you, you know, like quests. And you can also go to a bar and like you can ask around for like, you know, rumors and conjecture and like make more connections, get more quests. You can also play pool if you like. There's a friggin' pool game in this game, and it's good. you can play retro games, and they're good. It's like they got a real good version of Asteroids, which is funny, you know, because it's like literally Asteroids.
Yeah, I could waste way too much time on that.
Yeah, I also wasted way too much money playing the slot machines. I didn't even try the dice game, but you can win actual like in-game money that way. So you could actually gamble your way into a better ship, which is kind of fun. Then, like I said, there's another aspect that you could do, which is trading. You can purchase stuff, take it to a different planet where it's worth more, and then sell it. And then purchase stuff there, take that somewhere else, and sell that. Like, there's, like, you could actually, like, do, like, a trade route thing. And, like, part of the bar conversations is, like, finding out what best prices for what, you know, you're getting, like, hot tips on the market. And then, you know, sooner or later, you can become a space capitalist yourself. And, so yeah, that's like all of the options that you could do. And most of the game is honestly going to be you flying around a really nice, like, looking version of space with like all this stuff in it and like either debris or like whole planets going by. and you can like, it's basically going around doing that, you know, getting the money, getting the better ships. Like, I had never found a bottom. I would say it's probably infinitely There's so much. And then, of course, once you're good and ready, you can jump right back into that main quest and try and, like, you know, do your thing. So basically, the thing that, like, really, like, makes this one fun is, you know, that's all good. Like, I really like the simulation stuff, but also the fighting is really good. It's space dog fighting, which I remember, funny enough, the best game that I had, the game I'm the best at, because I've had it since I was a kid, for that is Destination Earthstar.
I never even NES heard game. Of that.
No one has. It was a budget game on the NES back in the day, but it was just like a first person go through. It was basically, it was Gary Kitchen's battle tank, if you've ever played that, but in space. It was just a first person thing where you go around a grid and find enemies and, like, dogfight them. Like, you know, once they show up on the camera, you, like, zap at them and then they, like, you know, move past you. So you have to turn around and chase them. This game is like that, except that this is 30 years later. So it's much better about it. The cool thing about this game is that, like, you know, you have your little grid radar, just like in the olden days. You have your actual, like, other radar on the left, which, when an enemy is, like, in view, it shows up, like, in your crosshairs and stuff, and then you can, like, speed up the ship to go and meet them. You can, like, do different maneuvers and things like that, and of course, you can just constantly blast your gun at them, when they show up on your actual screen. And, when they actually show up on your screen, or if you pull up this bigger 3D map where you can, like, target them, you can hold down the button, like it's, I think, the L2 button, and it will stay locked on that ship until you defeat it. So basically, you have a way to, like, automatically do the hard part, which is keeping them in your sights. So nice. That's the first time I've seen that in a space sim. I might be, of course, there's not a lot of space sims on the Switch. It's like two, I think. And but that really, like, pushes this into, like, really fun, snappy action territory rather than cumbersome, like, oh, we got to turn this junk around to, like, put the enemy back in our camera for a second. Like, you can actually, like, you know, take on, like, one of the earliest, like, missions has you fighting a whole bunch of, like, you know, hardy but helpless mercenary fighters. And yeah, you can, like, take on, like, five of them, and it, like, with relatively little skill, and it feels great to do it too. They explode in this nice big fireball on the screen. It's just, you know, awesome stuff. And sometimes they can call you on your radar, and yeah, so it's like, it's got really snappy fighting but really deep simulation, so that's like kind of a win-win as far as that goes. My only complaint, honestly, is I just don't like the protagonist because she's just this kind of, like, not one-dimensional, but, like, she very much is just, like, you know, everything is, like, either inconvenient or, like, just worthy of some kind of scowl or, like, sarcastic remark or, you know, this is bullshit kind of, you know, statement. And, you know, it's in the story, it's, like, fine. Okay, that's, you know, she has had a rough time. She, you know, her husband got killed and she crashed her ship and now she has to, like, you know, build everything up from scratch, and, you know, maybe things will get better later. But literally, her, like, voice comes in on everything that you do. From purchasing parts of a ship, she'll have a sarcastic comment. From fixing it, when she's playing Asteroids and she loses, she's like, ugh, okay. And, like, you know, like, every single time something happens, whenever, like, you know, you make a bad shot in pool, she has something to say about it. Like, you know, her voice is just there constantly. Of course, you could turn
it off.
Sounds
like my little sister, always has the last word.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you could turn off the voice acting, and you could turn off the music, which I did. But there's also, like, the music is kind of like dirt rock and, like, slide guitars and things like that, because it's, you know, basically trying to be a Western in space.
I know the store page mentions there's over 24 hours of music in the game.
Yeah, I was just going to say it has a Grand Theft Auto style radio system. And so you could just listen to, you know, scroll through stations and listen to them. And apparently, I only read about this. I didn't do it myself. But, like, if you they also have fake commercials. And if you change the channel too much when the commercial starts up, she actually has a comment about that, too. So that's pretty funny. So, yeah, it has a GTA-style radio system. I just kind of listen to my own jams, but it's still good music. So, you know, it's just kind of the kind of music that you would listen to if you were, you know, in Texas in space. Speaking of, literally, like, they call the star systems and stuff like that after states. So, like, the earliest one that you run into is Texas, and you're in the Texas star system. So there's, like, an Austin station, a Nacogdoches station, you know, a Lubbock station, which are all, of course, towns in Texas. So
nice.
Yeah, they do try to keep it. They keep it, like, somewhat grounded in a Westernish, like, you know, Americana type of thing. But, you know, at the core of it, it's just a really solid spaceship game that I really, really like.
Well, then $29.99 on it. What do you think of it?
I think space fans are not going to be disappointed. I think it's a slow burner. It's going to take you a while to be able to afford your first awesome ship, and you're not going to be able to really, like, they stop you in the beginning of, like, the main quest so that you can purchase a thing that you do not start off with enough money for. So you actually have to, like, start doing work between missions. So, you know, to earn money. But this is, as a slow burn, this is an excellent game, and there's so much content in it that I definitely recommend it. I say it's a buy it.
Cool. All right. Next game to talk about is called Going Under, developed by Agro Crab, published by Team 17, released September 24th on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $19.99. Going Under is a satirical dungeon crawler about exploring the cursed ruins of failed tech startups. As an unpaid intern in the dystopian city of Neo Cascadia, you'll wield office junk as weaponry as you make your way through the offbeat procedural dungeons beneath your company campus. Pernell, tell us about Going Under.
Oh, crap, you just kind of said it all. it's basically like Joe said, this game is a dungeon crawler. The idea is you play as Jacqueline, the intern, who is hired to do marketing work, but is actually just constantly being tasked with going to, like Joe said also, failed startups that exist beneath the company. Because apparently the startups that fail end up resulting in going under, literally, and the employees become demons or monsters or whatever, and then you have to fight them. But sometimes they escape and come into the main company that you work for, which is Fizzle, so you were tasked with clearing out their hubs so that they don't interrupt your corporate lifestyle. So the way it works is, the thing is, it's pretty much like a typical dungeon crawler. You start out with one location, but as you finish it, you gain access to other ones, and you go underground, you go from room to room, and when you go to each individual room, you have to fight monsters to clear the room and then gain access to the next rooms within the floor. Eventually, you get to the end of a floor, and you access the exit, and then the game will hit you with one more wave of monsters before the hatch for the exit pops off, and you can go underground to the next floor. Eventually, you'll come across a boss, beat him, and then upon doing so, you can escape and then get some story elements and then proceed onward. So those are the usual bits, but the things that make the game kind of nifty, aside from the fact that it is a dungeon roguelike, is I think the theme is what really drives it home for me. Well, aside from the art, which is one of those games where I think it looks nicer when it's being played. But the theme of it made me interested in wanting to try it in the first place, because otherwise it's like, okay, what makes this roguelike special? And the thing about it is, like, when you're underground, each location is a different company, and each of those locations kind of runs on its own different themes. Like, for example, one area might have you like wielding pickaxes and swinging pendulums, and another one might have you fighting with pencils and staplers, like that fire staples when you push them in, and then eventually you start beating enemies with it. Each weapon has an attack level and a durability level. And once you've used it up a certain amount, it'll break or explode if it's that kind of weapon. You can throw the weapons as well. So as you run through the dungeon, you'll eventually come across a shop every once in a while, which you can then proceed to and make purchases, whether it be items, which can be used as immediate weapons, healing items, which will give you health back, or perks. Perks are generally skills that will apply in the dungeon, such as, I don't know, like being able to swing heavy weapons more easily, or doing double damage for a short period of time when you walk into a room. Now, In addition to that, every once in a while, you'll come across a room as well that might have a choice of two different perks you can pick up. And once you pick it up, you'll be able to use it for the remainder of the run. When you die, though, the game will check to see what you found as far as perks go, and it goes to a percentage meter. And once you've maxed that percentage meter out for that particular perk, you gain the ability to equip that perk before going on a dungeon run, so you can kind of start with whatever perk you kind of prefer. Though, unfortunately, you only really get like one or so, so you got to make it count. In addition to doing that kind of thing, you also have co-workers who can become your mentor, so to speak, as you're the intern. But the way you get them to mentor you is you have to fulfill office tasks for them, such as one of the easiest, most obvious ones is one of your co-workers wants a cappuccino machine for the office. So you have to, while underground, save up enough money to purchase a cappuccino machine from the dungeon shop, which then completes the quest. And for each quest you complete, you gain access to one more perk from that mentorship. So if you decide you want to have the cappuccino lady as your mentor, you select her, and every perk you unlock for her becomes accessible right then and there. So you might say, for example, find more money in chests, or gain the ability to shoplift one time at the store, things like that. And there's actually some pretty nifty little wacky ones, too. I think the shoplifting was one of my favorites. This plot says, I'll steal for you. Like, thanks, buddy, you're awesome. I think the writing is pretty cool, too. Like, some people might dislike the idea that, again, this is very satirical in regards to, like, capitalism and startups and, you know, unpaid work, unpaid labor and that kind of thing. But honestly, even if I weren't down with that kind of humor, I am down with that kind of humor because, yeah, I think it's very well written. I think it's good writing. I like the characters in the game. I like coming and interacting with them when I come out of dungeon runs. Also, there's a dog that you can pet, which is nice. I think you got to mention that nowadays because they do whole websites devoted to, can you pet the dog? So you can pet the dog in this.
Do you get an achievement for it?
That I don't know. I didn't get one, but pet him 200 times or something. Maybe. You know, they do that kind of stuff. But
How hard is it to just give us an achievement for petting the dog? Come on, developers.
Because petting the dog is the achievement in and of itself. That's the reward. Petting the dog. True. It makes you feel so good. Now, how is the combat when you fight in this game? Well, honestly, it's fairly fluid. You can do melee attacks. You can throw items. And the only thing I will say I don't like is that there's a charge attack, which you can do by holding down the button and then letting it go. However, it's one of those charge attacks where while you're doing it, you kind of stop moving for the charge. And you're not moving for a long enough period of time where I feel like I really want to do it. Like, you kind of have to start the wind up before an enemy comes up to you. So he walks into your release, which is, you know, makes sense, but it's not as fun as just, you know, holding it, peppering it, and then just going to mashing a guy. But that is pretty much the combat. It's not complicated. It's not overly intense. It's literally swing, charge, swing, and throw stuff. That's the combat. Also, one, two things I need to mention too. One, every once in a while you're running on the floors, you might come across like a little bit of a mission. And a mission will say something like, I don't know, beat all the enemies in the room before time's up, or collect all the Styx coin, which is basically Bitcoin, before time runs up. And you're basically, those missions will start up, and depending on how well you do, you'll get rewards determined based off money or new weapons to swing around or qubits. Qubits are the currency that's specifically tailored towards buying new perks when you come back up topside. And when you buy the perks in the form of apps or whatnot, they become available when you purchase, when you're down in the dungeons working. Also there's apps. Apps are specifically little cell phone adaptions where when you find them on the ground, they give you like temporary abilities where you like say push the button to get a quick heal, but there's a limited number of them that you can do before it wears off. You can only have one running at one time. So once you pick one up, the other one goes. So, but that's okay. I mean, it's kind of like, it's the equivalent of like how some games give like a weapon, like a special side ability. In this case, the side ability is just getting apps. So I feel like ultimately the game is genuinely fun. It's either going to be very short or very long, depending on how good you are at these games, because it's literally just those small dungeons. There's not a ton of them. But if you have trouble beating the dungeons, well, you're going to be at it for a while. But if you're the type that can just kind of go in here and mow it down, you'll be done fast. But As to what kind of gamer you are in that regard, I can't answer and I don't know. But what I can tell you is that I think this game is a fair bit of fun. And it is definitely something that I am glad I got to review. But if I didn't review, I probably would have purchased it anyway. Because obviously I asked for it because I was already interested. Well, interest confirmed, and I would have totally purchased this game. So,
well, you could always buy it for me.
No, I'm broke.
No, you're not. I see all your rolls of fucking quarters that you have at home.
That's getting me free sandwiches.
You're saving so much money by not having to buy lunch.
Yeah, that's why I needed to save the money. There's reasons for that. People save money to pay bigger debts.
Oh, Lord. Speaking of paying debts, Cole, thank you for the 131 biddies. George, take it away.
Break my legs.
Drop it, bitch.
Oh, Lord. So going under $20, Pernell, what do you think?
I think it's totally worth it. Please buy, otherwise I'm going to get my legs broke.
Sounds good. Yeah, it does. It does sound good.
You like the idea of my legs getting broke?
Yeah.
A little bit.
I think we're all on board with that.
Damn it. At least I got you're the Chris.
Only
Chris
one who's on not side. On. That's very selfish Chris of you, Pernell.
To not be Chris on board is on with my that. Side.
Always.
See, that's Chris. My voice. People like Chris. He's supposed
to be cream soda.
Chris. He deserves that cream soda because he's kind.
Lord. All right. Next game to talk about is called Castle Storm 2, developed and published by Zen Studios, released September 23rd on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and Epic Game Store for $19.99. What is Castle Storm 2, you ask? Better question, what isn't it? Projectile warfare, tower defense, brutal combat, whimsical characters, epic campaigns of kingdom conquering, tactical strategy, zombie sheep, gaming's greatest super duper genre mashup awaits. All tell us about Castle Storm 2.
I did not expect all of the genre mashing going on with this game. I was like, oh, resource management, build up a castle, build up a kingdom, pick some fights. Fuck yeah, I'm down. And then I'm like, why the fuck am I controlling a ballista turret and trying to save a flag? Why are there zombie sheep? That the zombie sheep might be the best part, yeah. To be honest. This is like the one part I'm the least mad about.
Why haven't there been zombie sheep prior is the real
This question. Is the thing that more games need. You don't even need a good reason for zombie sheep. Just the moment they're there, everybody's like, that's fucking awesome. That's zombie sheep. I'm fully on board with that part of the game. So when you start the game, you run through a tutorial where basically, like, it tells you how to use your, I don't know if he's a knight, I don't know if he's a prince. I was very confused by the actual story here, and I think part of that's because I didn't play Castle Storm, so I didn't know what the fuck I was getting into. I was just like, yeah, this is a dude, we're gonna whack things with a sword. I don't need a whole lot of backstory, I'm fine, I get where we're going here. I don't know his whole ordeal. I'm sure somebody who paid more attention could tell you a little more than that. I was kind of focused on shit looks good and it hasn't killed my console yet. I did have one bug immediately out the gate that I just really need to talk about because it's fucking driving me nuts.
Okay.
Even though Castle Storm 2 lets you use your controller to just like press certain buttons for different options, there's a lot of elements in the menus that require you to move around a cursor icon. That is the most ineffective cursor in the fucking world. And I don't know why. Like, there's no good reason for it being as jank as it is.
I don't know if that's a bug. It's...
No, like, it just... There are times where... It just doesn't go. And it's not like, oh, it moves up and down the menu and highlights. Like, there's an actual cursor circle that you have to move around the screen. You don't have a lot of control over it. It just doesn't, it just doesn't want to go where you tell it to at times.
I didn't have a problem with that. It moved where I wanted it to go.
Okay, well, you know what? You're special. I had issues. I couldn't get that fucker to do what I wanted sometimes. especially on the main menus.
You don't have any controller drift, do you?
No. Hmm. I actually specifically checked that too. And I used different controllers just to see, because I thought it was me. And I was like, because I know that one of my thumbsticks, it doesn't drift, but it's just like loose in the socket because I drop shit and I've dropped my controller a million times.
Proud of you.
So like it's loose in the socket, but it doesn't actually drift. And I was like, well, that ain't it. it just doesn't want to go sometimes for me. I just wish that it was more of like a highlight system and there were actual just keypad bindings for everything rather than making you deal with the cursor.
Yeah, we've seen that in a lot of games. I know Destiny has menu systems like that. Doesn't the Division have menus like that too?
No. Or,
I thought the Division did. What am I thinking of that has...
I'm not sure, but the Division just has the normal like highlight the button thing. It's like a box, but no, I don't know. I've seen the cursors more frequently. Sometimes they work well, and sometimes they don't. And just for me, in this instance, it just didn't. And so that's really like my number one complaint with the game.
Is that cursor? That cursor
was a fucking nightmare. Also, it's such a thin little line of a circle that it was really easy to lose.
Yeah.
That was my biggest beef. Anyway, beyond that, the game really does well with mashing up the insane amount of genres they decided to throw in a pot here. It's kind of difficult to be like, you play games, we play a shit ton of games. Look, 10, 12 games a week is not a thing for us, right? And so, like... You see games that struggle to be a really good tower defense. And then you see a game that struggles to just be a really good RTS. And then you see one that just struggles to be a really good resource manager. And yet somehow Castle of Storm 2 is like, hey, we're going to building all these. We're just going to put them all right here and let you have all of it. And you're like, I don't know why, but for the most part, it works out okay. The general progression of how you go from, oh, I'm on the map and I'm managing things like a RTS. In fact, the very first time it brought me to the map, I was like, oh, this is like a, what was it, Armello? Armello. Yeah. And I was like, this feels familiar and I know what I'm doing with this. And then immediately, like, it went into building up my troops and the army that I had access to, and I was like, oh, this feels like Halo Wars. So every time I was jumping from one element of the game to another, even though I had never played the first, I knew what to expect because it was elements I was familiar with from other games, and they were done well enough and reasonably enough that you could just kind of fall into it and figure it out. One of the neat elements is that even though you're on the first screen and you've got like an RTS kind of layout, you can then go into a combat screen where, you know, it's tower defense and that you'll have a flag stuck somewhere or whatever that you have to protect from the oncoming hordes. Gotta love the zombie sheep. But, you actually have different ways that you can control those battles, and you're not just tied to, oh, I'm in the ballista, or oh, I have some god powers where like I can make lightning strike down with magic or whatever. You can actually zoom in on any one of the guards and take over control of them and fight with them. You can literally throw them to the wolves and let them die if you want to. I had a really bad habit of that. I was like, just keep sending people to die. I would say I would like to see an option to turn off friendly fire. I think the game would be a lot easier if you could get rid of friendly fire. It is not my fault that the AI runs in front of a burst javelin, okay? I cannot control which way the winds will blow. You only have so much you can say over where those javelins are going to shoot to, and you can't do shit if that's the moment where all of your crew are like, let's go smash the wolves. And then like they eat 8 of your burst javelins back to back and die.
Yeah. I've lost complete games. Like I've had game overs because I would shoot a fucking spiked ball at a wolf, and my commander would run up and do a special attack and jump up in the air and get just nailed by this fucking spiked ball.
There's nothing you can do about it either. I like the concept that, oh, you can control from all these different angles and be on the battlefield in whatever way suits you best, but the friendly fire just tanks all the enjoyment for me. I'm sure there are people who are like, hardcore, fuck yeah. I'm not it. Okay. And I don't want to have to deal with that shit. And I don't want to have to sit and be like, I don't have to go move my troops before I shoot a javelin. And then they're going to run up there again. Anyway, I don't want to deal with it. I just want to shoot. And if some poor bastard stands in front of the javelin, that's his fucking fault. I don't want to have to be punished for that.
Yeah.
Beyond that, though, the game looks great, plays really well. It's kind of hard to talk about because there's so much there, but also it's so on the nose with it that, like, you can't really deep dive it. You're like, well, it's an RTS part here, and it's a tower defense there, and then it's you can go to build a mine and mine resources and deal with your resources and stuff. But once you know what it is, that's kind of just all there is there. There's not a lot beyond just, hey, this is a mashup of 74 million different genres.
Yeah, it's not the deepest, but there is a lot of content there. Like, this is these levels are long.
Oh my god, I didn't think I was ever going to get through it.
I know.
Every time I was just like, there's got to be an end here somewhere. Nope, never mind, still going. Because I'm like, I have to go and cook a meal. I got a kid in the class. I need a save point. Something has to shake. But you can, when you are going to play it, you need to know that you have the time to, like, sit down and sink your teeth into it. You're going to be there a while.
Yeah.
I appreciate that the content's there, though. And I mean, how could it not be? There's 972 genres to choose from.
Yeah. Well, overall, $20 on this one. What do you think of it?
I'm going to roll with a recommended try it. I don't think this is a game for everybody. And I think that it's kind of niche in who it's going to apply to. It's got some really neat concepts. I appreciate that they've mashed all this up and just said, let's see what happens. But I appreciate that if you're used to any of these genres, you're going to be able to fall into the game in some way or another. But it could be a little easier.
Yeah.
And it could just be, like, tweaked to be a little more forgiving and a little more functional with the menus. It's not bad. It's just that it could be better as well.
Yeah. Well, we could bitch out Chris when he's here.
Yeah.
It's all your fault, Chris. Not you, Chris. Other Chris.
Oh. Okay. There's so many Chris's.
Too many Chris's.
Draw Chris out of a hat.
Yeah. Chris Huber, it's your fault. You. Fuck. All right. Next game to talk about is called Paradise Killer, developed by Kaizen Gameworks, published by Fellow Traveler, released September 4th on Switch and PS or PC, Switch and PC for $19.99. I can't talk. Paradise Island, a world outside reality. There's been a murder the only investigation freak Lady Love Dies can solve. Gather evidence, interrogate suspects in this open world adventure. You can accuse anyone, but you'll have to prove your case in trial to convict. It's up to you to decide who's guilty. Chris, tell us about Paradise Killer.
Oh, boy. Okay, Paradise Killer. So, this is the one I spent, like, the most time on, because it's intriguing. So, Paradise Killer is a little bit like... Okay, so you are a lady. In fact, your name is Lady. Lady Love Dies. That's your name. I'm going to tell you ahead of time, like, every name in this game... like, sounds like some hipster's Gmail, like, password. So you play an investigator who, for some reason, was exiled to 3 million days of I guess, sleep or something like that. I ran that through a calculator, by the way. That's like 8,200 years.
Jesus.
Yeah. But then she's called back into action by the judge. That's just named Judge, which is, like, two ladies that have been kind of, two or three maybe, who have been, like, kind of melted together. And like it, she has a very like Ashura like look about her, like with the three faces and like two pairs of arms and things like that. And yeah, this judge is like basically saying that the see, like, anytime I begin to like describe anything about the plot in this game, it goes completely off the rails because none of it makes sense. It's all like, it all works within its own context, but it's also weird. So there's a council who is in charge of trying to make a kind of island for people to a very like touristy, like 80s-ish kind of island. Like it's the version, it's kind of like Synthwave, which by the way is the soundtrack. It's like, it's a version of the 80s that people who weren't born in the 80s imagine that it would be in the future. Anyways, so there's like this touristy island type thing that is, you know, kind of like taken care of and like ruled by the council of the syndicate. And like the syndicate, I guess, is just this collection of people who live forever, whatever. It has something to do with some gods or demons, whatever. And, but then this council all gets murdered in one night. And your job is to figure out who done it. And, then as you take on that mystery, well, they have a suspect in custody who you're supposed to talk to and stuff, but they, feel like that, I guess, you know, there's more to the story and that you're basically, you're the investigator, or what is it? The investigation freak.
Yeah.
Like they keep using things like that, like monikers for you, like that. And, so you're basically walking around this island, which is largely uninhabited. It's got the suspects on it. It's got some other characters on it as well, but it's not like filled with people or anything because the way that the islands work, I guess they built them to appease the gods in some way. And they like offer blood sacrifices and things like that. It's got an eldritch element to it. And these gods, by the way, are, implied to be like big spooky aliens. And, you know, you can tell if you look around the island because, you know, on top of being very neon and 80s looking, it also has, like, black pyramids coming out of the sea and, like, giant bits of machinery all around. And, like, you know, there's beach blankets on the beach, but there's also, like, these gold, like, you know, obelisks, you know, things like that. And it's really quite intriguing. And like, you basically walk around the island and pick up items as you see them. They're all, like, everything that is that you can interact with in the game is actually a 2D like cardboard cutout kind of looking thing, even though the island itself is a very nice looking 3D. So it's interesting that they kind of, you know, put those together like that. And anyways, so every time you interact with something, it's either a clue that's going to help you in your investigation, or it is a just a bit of lore about the island. And the cool thing about it is that this game really kind of makes you investigate, because you can't come into this game with any understanding of it. You have to learn about this island within its own context. Nothing makes real world sense on this island. And it, in fact, is supposed to exist in like an alternate, you know, reality dimension, whatever. So not only are you learning all about what's going on and creating a, you know, a context to try and figure out, you know, who done these murders, and some other murders that occur and some other murders, like,
a lot of murders, in this game.
They start to pile on. Yeah. And are they linked?
I'm glad to hear that, because I was genuinely worried that I was going to be like, is this the one murder? And the story never really twists and turns. It's just you learn new stuff about the same case.
You learn different cases that are like kind of connected, kind of if you want them to be. So the way this game operates is very strange, because it kind of changes the story based on the decisions you make in conversation on the fly. It's almost like this game is like a master improv actor. And just whenever you feed it certain decisions, it kind of, it goes with it and it does a yes. And so, you know, oh yes, you've done this. And now this character's going to act in this way. And this character's going to act in this way. And of course, you're going to gather like evidence and things like that. But even they tell you right at the beginning, it's like facts are not truth. You have to present truth. And so once you have collected enough stuff to make a case, then at any point really in the game, you can access the ending. And the ending is, well, so here's the problem. I haven't played any courtroom video games like Phoenix Wright or anything, so I don't know how to compare this to them. I'm just going to say that right out of the gate. You basically spend the last hour of the game in a courtroom scene with the judge, who, by the way, there is no jury, and the judge is like pretty much completely on your side. So it's not, you know, what do they call it, kangaroo court? It's like, it's absolutely corrupt. But, you know, the island's about to end, and they're going to have to move into a new island very soon, so you kind of have to be snappy about it. Because these islands, I guess, get destroyed ever so often. Like, the island you're on is number 24, and everybody's, you know, about to move on to island 25, which, you know, is why it's important to figure out this murder, because they don't want to bring people to 25 that are doing the murders, because they keep trying to make a utopian society, whatever. And the fools. So the last hour is basically taking all the evidence that you've piled up and logged into your computer, which, by the way, is a very important character in the game. It's Starlight, the laptop, which looks, of course, like a crappy laptop, but it holds on to like all of your stuff. Like, so you can go over notes, you can look at evidence, you can change the soundtrack. You actually collect the soundtrack in the game, along with all the other clues. You only start off with like 3 songs, and I think you build it up to like 16. And, yeah, so you basically open up your laptop and go over all your notes, and it gives you this nice little like rundown of everything that you've heard and said about every different character. And the more stuff you have on a character, the more you can convince the judge that you have a case against them. And then, of course, from there on, you basically are using this system to try and put everybody behind bars. Now, of course, if you haven't gathered enough evidence, the judge probably won't believe you, and then, you know, you don't get to win the case. So it's important to get enough evidence, but really, and I'm not going to spoil anything, but really, yeah, a lot of it is basically up to, you know, your word goes. But there is, of course, like I said, a lot of weight based on like how much exploration you can do. And the cool thing about it, because it's like kind of visual novel style, there's so much information to take in about the world that you find yourself wanting to know like all this stuff. Like, you know, it's not about the end of the game, it's the journey and getting to know these characters and like kind of being in your feelings about everybody and kind of using your intuition. Like I said, it's a game that really does a great job in really making you feel like you're in the role of Lady Love Dies at gmail.com.
Oh, God. Well, $20 on this one. What do you think of it?
I think it's fantastic, and I would recommend it to anybody who likes absurd or abstract type of stuff, but like with a real like complexity to it. It is a unique experience. I can't think of anything else that's quite like this game, so I'm going to give it a buy it.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, next game is called Unrailed, developed by Indoor Astronaut, published by Daedalic Entertainment, released September 23rd on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $19.99. Unrailed is a co-op multiplayer game where you have to work together with your friends to build a train track across endless procedurally generated worlds, master random encounters with its inhabitants, upgrade your train, and keep it from derailing. Brunel, tell us about Unrailed.
Unrailed is going to be a weird one to review because of, well, after I describe it, you'll understand, but it falls kind of in a weird place. But Unrailed is a cool little, you know, co-op game. Like, I love how it's, I always say, like Joe said. essentially, the idea is that you start, there's multiple modes, mind you. Like, there's like quick versions and endless versions, blah, blah, blah. But for the most part, every mode involves you doing a thing where you start on the left side of the screen. There is a train that is moving along a set of railroad tracks. You need to keep that train moving, you and your friends anyway. The question is, how do you do that? Well, the train moves automatically so long as there's track in front of it. But if it ever reaches a point where there isn't any track in front of it, the game is immediately over. The way you keep that train going is by doing some very simple steps. On every session, there's one pickaxe and one axe. You need to take the pickaxe to mine for rock by destroying rock formations. You need to take the axe to mine for, well, chop down trees for wood, and then combine them into one of the train cars which is then used to produce railroad tracks. And then you run them up and put them in front of the train, and boom, it keeps moving. Depending on how long a session goes between checkpoints, the train will go faster and faster, which means that you'll need to work faster to keep this thing going. Now, at the same time as you're doing this, well, a few things are happening. One, the screen is scrolling automatically from left to right. So if you end up letting certain stuff fall off the screen, you're in a bit of trouble. Thankfully, I never let that happen. My desk came from normal stuff, but my assumption is that if one of your tools falls off the screen, you'll probably lose it and thus end the game. Also, in addition to that, there's just a variety of little bits of like pressure that takes place. So, for example, you can't run through the train, and you can't run through any of your companions, and you will always have a companion. If you're not playing with humans, you will be playing with an AI. And as this has gone on, you might find yourself in situations where there's like a narrow passage or a corridor, and if you're both in there, you'll be bumping each other. So you got to coordinate your efforts, know who's going to be mining for what, who's going to be chopping for what, who's going to be moving the parts to the train, and who's going to be laying the track. Also, sometimes the train will catch fire, because trains do that, apparently. And when this happens due to overheating, there's also a bucket item, which you need to then run to the water, likely a river or a stream or a pond that's on the stage. You then fill it with water by standing in front of it. Then you rock the bucket to the train to put the fire out. All this combines to result in some rather chaotic interactions as you're trying to keep this train going in as coordinated a way as possible. Now, each time you get to a checkpoint in the form of a train station, you'll get the opportunity to spend bolts that you earn from making successful runs to upgrade the train in a variety of ways. You can get new train cars, which will provide you with new abilities, such as the ability to produce dynamite to blow up larger rock formations, or you can upgrade the train cars you've already got. So you might want to be able to store more train tracks on the train proper. Or you might find yourself thinking you want to be able to stock or stack more wood and ore, or the wooden stone on the train to produce the stuff. Because if you can't get on the train, it'll just stay on the ground, which makes it prone for getting scrolled off the screen. Or on occasion, NPCs will just pick it up and steal it off the ground because they're assholes like that. So there's a variety of things you can do with your money to do that. In addition, every once in a while, after you upgrade the main train car, which is usually the primary way to slow the train down, because when you really lay it on the table, the train speed, I think, is kind of intended to pressure you to move to new areas. So every time you upgrade the main train car, the train will slow down again, and you'll go to a new biome area, which is essentially like a volcanic area or like a snow-covered area, and for example. And those each have their own hazards that you have to endure to proceed. And in addition to the normal hazards that those areas might have, there's also the generic one of just the sun going out, because day and night will pass. And when the sun goes down, your visibility becomes limited, and it's hard to keep track of your stuff. Ultimately, the game itself is pretty easy to comprehend and understand. And the game is also not hard to play. I actually consider it to be kind of a Zen game in certain respects. But organizational Zen, meaning that if you can't get organized, you're going to fuck up and you're going to be sad you did, because that's the kind of game this is. You will not be surprised to find yourself realizing that you unfortunately didn't stockpile enough wood, or you built the train tracks improperly and wasted tracks, so now you can't actually build enough track to get to the train station because you ran out of wood or brick. You might not have dug a wide enough tunnel, so now you can't get to the front of the train car to put a fire out because you can't run in front of the train. Weird stuff that you wouldn't think you would do, you're going to do. And it's going to drive you crazy. But that's kind of the fun of it. The game itself isn't your typical game, though, in that there is no real, like you're not unlocking new stages or anything like that. You're not, they're not progressing to an ending. The game is endless and procedurally generated. And the alternative to that would be like there's like a quick version where you can just kind of do like a session that just has like one or two stations just to kind of get a feel for the game and then you put it down. But that's kind of the intent, I think, is just to have that moment where you sit down with your friends or by yourself if you really can get down with the AI and essentially lay some track. In addition to the normal mode, there is also a versus mode where you can battle against your friend or friends to see who can build their track out the longest. And you can sabotage the other players and stuff like that. But unfortunately, that one is one that you really need to get people to play with you on. So if you don't have friends to play with you, whoopsie doodle. But if you can get people together to play it, I think you'll be in for a treat. But the game itself, I think, is a lot of fun. The only hurdle becomes if you don't have people to do multiplayer with, I think the AI would get old. So it's hard to recommend if you play single player only. But if you're going to get a healthy mix of single player and multiplayer, and especially if you like voxel graphics, which I do, then it is a buy it in that regard. But if you're playing it alone, exclusively, I would honestly go with a so-called, as far as say to tonight, because this game was meant to be played with friends. Like this, I mean, think about it. It's like, I'm trying to think of a game like that, but I guess it's like Overcooked. Like Overcooked has a single player mode, and I'm sure they put effort into making the single player mode, but Overcooked without friends is kind of droll. And this one I feel is the same way. Like it's fun, but it'll get old fast because ultimately you want to yell at people. You want to compete with people. You want to Gordon Ramsay your friends. Really, that's what I think of when I think of these kinds of games. And if you're not getting that out of it, you honestly should probably be playing something else. But if you are going to play with your friends, and you do have that kind of interaction, I think you should get on board with this bad boy.
Cool. Sounds good.
It is.
All right.
Honestly, makes me wonder, like, I wonder if couples could play this game. Like, just get sit down with your spouse or something. And because I know Overcooked will make you get divorced. But this game, maybe not so much. This one might be less of that. But it'd be interesting to find out.
I don't know. Nothing ever ends up positive when I try to play games with my husband. I'm better than he is, and I don't have the tolerance for his bullshit.
Well, I mean, if you're playing competitive games, then it's not a big deal.
I don't care if it's competitive or not. I don't have time for his bullshit.
That's why you win. It's competitive. You're supposed to have time.
No, I mean, even if it's a cooperative game, I don't have time for his bullshit.
Oh, God. But I would figure if it was competitive, you're like, you know.
Oh, if it's competitive, he won't play it with me at all because
he knows.
That's not even a fair fight. He knows.
He knows the beatdown's coming. Love you, boo.
Like, that shit's grounds for divorce. That's what happens there.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, dear.
Jesus ain't here. Only winning.
In other news, I have moved on to my Dr. Pepper and cream soda, so I've joined you.
Hey. I've just finished mine.
Now we need Cole to get red, white, and berry vodka, and then I'll have a companion too.
I'm not allowed to have alcohol.
Shoot.
I'm allowed to, but I don't like it, so.
You know what you are allowed to have, Cole?
Huh?
Reviews. Bad segues. Next game to talk about is called Nexomon Extinction, developed by Vivo Interactive, published by P-Cube, released September 25th on Xbox One for $19.99. Nexomon Extinction is a return to classic monster-catching games, complete with a brand new story, eccentric characters, and over 300 unique Nexomon to trap and tame. Cole Purnell covered this one a couple of weeks ago. It finally hit Xbox. What do you think of it?
So, if you were going to make a proper segue, what you would have said was, you know what Cole's not allowed to have? Pokemon, because she's allergic to playing on the Switch. So instead, she gets to play Nexomon. I have never played a Pokemon game in my life. By the time Pokemon became a thing, I was already at the cusp of graduating high school, and that was gone over my head. I do have a 7-year-old daughter who is a Pokemon freak, like to the extreme. It's stressful. So when I loaded up Nexomon, I thought the best way to test this game is to see her reaction to it. Because this is a kid who can sit and, like, name every evolution of every Pokemon ever. It's a thing. And so I sat her down, and I launched the game, and I didn't say a thing about Pokemon. And immediately she goes, "Can I play this?" And I said, "You sure can." And from the jump, she already knew what to do because she's played Pokemon until her little tiny fingers have fallen off. And I don't find that to be a negative. There's a lot of ways where I would normally be like, oh, well, this game doesn't break its genre in any kind of way. It's not enough of a swap up to make you feel like you're playing something new. And you could very easily say that about Nexomon, except for if you haven't played Pokemon for any particular reason, but you are interested in that monster training genre, this is a good place to start. It really can let you get a handle on the genre and teach you how to play it and maybe make you realize that you kind of want to spend your time catching all these super adorable little monsters and leveling the fuck clean up out of them.
And the good thing that this game has over Pokemon is that PlayStation and Xbox gamers can play this one.
Exactly. Because I'm never going to pick up the Switch and like become a normal Switch gamer. I've tried. It hurts my hands. It's just not an option. I know it. We have one normal controller, and even that is smaller.
He's a Hori Hayabusa.
I don't even know what that shit.
It's like a big arcade stick.
Oh, that's Lord.
Actually not as bad an option for somebody like me as you might think it is because my fingers are crooked. But it's just not something I'm ever going to find myself attaching to. And so I kind of felt like, well, everybody's all, oh, Pokemon is out again and it's a thing and it's a craze and everybody loves Pokemon. And I'm like, I'm never going to play it. I have Sword and Shield in here and I'm never going to play it. And I never get to play anything like it because I prefer my Xbox. And now I actually have a legitimate chance with Nexomon, and it stands up to the criticism. You could put it up against Pokemon and be like, yeah, it holds its weight. It bears its own. It's different enough that you don't feel like you're playing a full-on clone, but it's similar enough that it scratches the itch and gets you what you want from that genre, and it's everywhere. And that's great.
Pernell, I know you played this one. Do you have any thoughts to chime in on that?
I would say I partially agree there, because the only thing it lacks, which I get, well, there are a few elements that don't make, where they don't compare in a sense, but the main one is that, unfortunately, it lacks multiplayer. So you can't do the whole competitive aspect of it, but from a solo, just playing by myself aspect of it, it is genuinely a fun game. I still think it's a fun game. The grind can get a little bit annoying, though, essentially, just because I felt like after every battle, I was pretty much running back to a healing stop to replenish my health, because money does not grow on trees in this game, despite trainers respawning fairly quickly. So you are not going to be desiring to spend your hard-earned money on potions that you're going to burn through like mundane encounters. So just be ready to do a lot of backtracking for healing. But otherwise, while it doesn't quite dethrone the master in this regard, it's still a genuinely good time to play. And I think I actually personally like the Nexomon designs that they did too. They're fairly clever. They're fairly well made.
You get to choose from 9 starters. And let's just go ahead and throw out there that that's fucking awesome.
Well, why don't you think about that too? But I think it's actually kind of a good thing. I think this will be varying by player. But the thing about the 9 starters, though, is that they're not limited to the starters. Like, you can catch those in the wild too. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to be sitting. I mean, it's worth noting in advance, because when it was time to choose my first, I was like, shoot, which one do I want? I'm all rumbling around like, which one is the better one? But in the end, you don't even have to break your neck deciding, because you'll just see them all later anyway. So just choose the one that seems the coolest to you and just go with it.
Yeah, I think it was where you mentioned the going back for the health. That was the one thing. It was funny because when we were playing, it was me, number 2, and number 3. And we were literally just like doing a couple of battles and then passing the controller around. And the one thing that the girls spoke up, and remember, I haven't played Pokemon and I didn't fucking know what I was doing, but they are Pokemon nuts. And one of the things that they pointed out was that it was just a little difficult at times to just kind of explore, because you were constantly running into the trainers and getting into the fights and then having to backtrack a lot. So we can definitely agree on that one. And that there weren't enough like potions and things like that. You were just burning through them too quickly. I also completely forgot where my second part of that thought was going.
However,
it's gone.
Proud of you. Well, since you lost it, I'll just ask, $20 on Nexomon Extinction. What do you think of it now that it's finally on Xbox?
I'm willing to give it a buy it. I know that Purnell mentioned that there's no multiplayer aspect to it, but I think given the fact that we don't have anything else like this on Xbox that really compares to this degree, I don't mind that it doesn't have it, because I think it's good enough to let you get a taste and decide if this is the kind of game that you want, and then let you get your bearings about it before you move on to something bigger like Pokemon, where you actually are battling other people.
Nice. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right, next game is called Embracelet, developed and published by Machine Boy, released September 24th on Switch and PC for $11.99. Embracelet is an adventure game set in northern Norway, a unique coming-of-age story about love, loss, friendship, and family, and a magical bracelet with mysterious powers. Chris, tell us about Embracelet.
Okay, as soon as I unmute my mic.
Works for me.
Yeah. Okay, so Embracelet. Yes, this is a, so it's kind of like a, just a, it's hard to not call it a walking simulator, but I guess you do things in it. You like interact with stuff and things like that. So, in that sense, I guess it is a like walking around adventure game. So you are Jesper, who is a 17-year-old boy who is basically like, He's in a family of three, essentially. Like, it's him and his mom and his ailing grandfather, who basically like gives him a magical bracelet, and this bracelet allows Jesper to basically have like telekinesis. He can maneuver like objects of like any kind of size with this bracelet. And the grandfather got it from a small island called Slep. They're all Norwegian, so this all takes place in Norway. And he tells Jesper that he needs to go to Slep and figure out, basically he needs to take that bracelet back to where it came from, because he feels like this grandfather, after so many years of having used it, feels compelled that it should go back where it came from. And now that I'm saying it out loud, it kind of sounds like Lord of the Rings. But anyways, so, you know, and this kid has, you know, problems of his own. You know, he failed a test at school, so he has to do his homework and, you know, over the summer and retake the test, and his mom is swamped at work and such. So when he tries to get his mom to get him to go to this island, of course she says no. So then he does all his homework, and at the end of the summer he passes the test, and that's the end of the game. No, I'm just kidding. He goes to the island.
Womp womp.
Womp womp. And so yeah, at the island, like, that's where the story kind of like unfolds, and you kind of learn, you know, you're to learn more about like the bracelet, more about your grandfather, more about, you actually, you know, meet some characters and become friends. And it becomes as much about the bracelet as it does like about the kid. You know, it is like a coming of age story, and it's very, I'm going to say like relaxed. You know, no harm befalls anybody really. And also the act of using the bracelet is the only real gameplay in the game. And all it is it's one ring that gets smaller and one ring that gets bigger. And when they meet in the middle, you're supposed to push the B button only once. And that's how you use the bracelet. It's a rhythm game with one note. So that's it. The rest of it is reading. And fortunately, this game is extremely well written. I actually really, really like the story. I like little touches that they add in into the world, which is interesting that there's details in the game that like I really appreciated and resonated with, because the presentation is actually a little bit low polygon, and the polygons aren't textured, so it kind of has this unique art style going on with it, where people kind of look more like puppets. but it just hits that line of being realistic enough that you really, like, you know, when the kid hugs his mom during a particularly emotional moment, then, you know, you really get sucked into it. So, like, something's effective. And then, like, they have little touches, like, in his bedroom, which, you know, is obviously his childhood bedroom. There's a freaking picture of a fighter jet, a poster of a fighter jet on the wall. And he's like, Grandpa got me for this for me when I was, like, 10 years old. And I, you know, I think it's goofy now. And I'm like, I had that exact poster. This is so funny. So yeah, it's a really charming, surprisingly emotionally, like, hefty and also really good looking despite its, like, its minimalist presentation. Like, it's overall just a great package of a story. Like I said, the only thing that it kind of falters on is that it only has one thing in the gameplay besides looking around and clicking on items and stuff like that. But, you know, it's walking around and looking at things, and honestly, I'm just fine with it being that.
Good old walk-sploration.
Yeah, it's walk-sploration and a little bit of point and click, I guess.
And rhythm game, obviously.
And a one-note rhythm game. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Well, $12 on it. What do you think?
I'm going to give it a buy it, and I'm going to do that simply based on the strength of the writing and the, like, also the music, actually. It's really good music, too. It's also minimalist. It doesn't show up all the time, but when it does, it really, really does the trick. I say, yeah, if you're looking for a good emotional adventure game experience, then, yeah, go for it. But don't expect any kind of, like, challenge or anything like that.
Cool. Sounds good. Yeah. All right, next game is called Twin Breaker, a Sacred Symbols Adventure, developed by Lilimo Games and East Asia Soft, published by East Asia Soft, released September 23rd on Xbox One, Switch, and Steam for $9.99. Twin Breaker, a Sacred Symbols Adventure is a story-driven, brick-breaking game molded in the style of 80s classic arcades like Arkanoid and Breakout, but with a plot, characters, and meaning. Pernell, tell us about Twin Breaker.
Well, Twin Breaker is Arkanoid. There you go.
Cool. $10. What do you say?
I'd say it's a try. So honestly, I could have been the review, but I'll try to do more.
Yeah, we need a little more.
So the idea behind the game is that you go from stage to stage, and on each level, you get a series of bricks that you need to break. Now, the gimmick in that which makes it Twin Breaker is that you always control minimum of two paddles, because the paddles are actually meant to portray spaceships piloted by two different people. So one ship works on the left side of the screen, the other ship works on the right side of the screen. When the ball gets launched up, it hits the bricks. Some bricks take one hit to break, some take more. When you eventually break the brick, you get points for it. Every once in a while when you break a brick, a power-up will fall from it, and if your paddle catches it, it will activate the power, whether it's additional points, or if it is a gun that you can fire from the paddles directly. When you do get the gun, though, it's auto fire. You don't have to press the button for it. A ball that just kind of plows through things that are bouncing off of them, etc. The one added gimmick that typical, you know, games like this don't have, well, there's technically three, I guess. One is that every time you hit a brick, the paddle that launched the ball will get like one notch on its power meter. And when it gets all three power meters full, you can launch a silhouette of the paddle upwards. So what that essentially does is allows you to rebound the ball before it hits the ground. So it's like saying, hey, I want this ball to make kind of like a trick shot to go up there before falling down. You can launch your paddle up. It'll hit it and it'll kind of angle. Though it's kind of hard sometimes to determine how the ball is going to react to the paddle collision, because I've had moments where I was like, okay, it's going to go at a 45-degree angle. I was like, nope, 90 or 72 or whatever. And it's just a pain in my ass. But it still works and gets the ball kind of juggled. Second thing is that some levels will let you use four paddles, meaning that the game will actually turn, will allow you to hit the paddle off the side. So it's like it'll be the top, the bottom left, bottom right, and then left side and the right side. And in which case, then the left side and the right side also become dead zones. If the ball falls out those sides, you also lose a life. And then lastly, there are boss encounters. So the boss encounters generally consist of just a brick formation looking thing with a face in various forms, like various varieties, and then they might have a cannon or something that can like neutral, like it can stun your paddle if it shoots at it and hits it, stuff like that. But that's pretty much how the game works. There's variations of modes, like there's like a boss rush mode where you can just fight all the bosses back to back and fight them in cycles where they get a little bit harder. Then there's the story mode, and there's the arcade mode where you can just do individual levels. The story mode, I didn't care about it. It's Arkanoid. I don't need a freaking deep plot for Arkanoid. And for the record, whoever wrote this went all in on the writing. There's like some, the intro alone, if you let it run, it'll take you 5 minutes to read the intro. Like what the story, the plot is, Earth's dying, ships get sent through wormhole. There's a lot going on there. They even go into like a whole description of like what becomes of the Earth's economy. Like it goes into a lot of text. And some people might dig that. I wasn't that guy. I wasn't getting down with that. Like I can applaud them for like trying, but then it was like, it's Arkanoid. I'm playing Arkanoid. That's it. But as far as the gameplay and the fun levels are concerned, I mean, I guess that also depends because again, once you take away the attempted writing, it's Arkanoid, just another Arkanoid. The music is good though, but the end result ends up becoming, do you like Arkanoid and do you miss it enough to buy a modernized version of the gameplay style? Because if you do, then you'll probably get a kick out of this. That's a general statement. A Purnell statement is, Arkanoid was better at the time when it was pretty much all it had. Like, that's what we could do, but that gameplay style would be better suited as, like, a versus thing where, like, I'm controlling paddles on the left side of the screen, my opponent's controlling paddles on the right, and we're fighting to break blocks for points and then kill the other player, something like that. But as a single-player experience, I feel like there's more waiting than actually doing, if you know what I mean, when it comes to Arkanoid games.
Well, that happens in every Arkanoid game. When you're near the end of a level and there's like two bricks left and it's the ball's just bouncing everywhere but where those fucking bricks are.
100% exactly that. And that's why like I try hard to like emphasize throughout this whole thing. It's literally Arkanoid. Like there's nothing being done here that's gonna make you go, you know, I didn't like Arkanoid, but this game is different. No, it's Arkanoid. So in that regard, if you didn't like Arkanoid in the past, you're not going to like this. If you've never played Arkanoid, then holy crap, that's a shock. then I guess give this a shot just to kind of get a vibe for like what some classic gaming was like. If you're interested in seeing a modernized take on it rather than going like to emulate or find like a Atari collection or something. But I do think that I could try it is about as high as I can go on this because I wasn't particularly like jazzed for it. And I don't think it's a bad game, but it also isn't one that gets me excited either. So I wouldn't go with deny. I think it falls in the try it category for sure.
That works.
I hope so. I got two paddles on it.
All right. Well, we got one final game to talk about tonight. That is called Swordbreaker, the game developed by Ducat's Game Studio, published by Sometimes You, released September 30th on Xbox One, Windows 10, PS4, and Vita for $4.99. The Swordbreaker game is interactive fiction with lots of illustrations where you and you alone get to choose the storyline and the ending. Cole, tell us about Swordbreaker, the game.
So Swordbreaker kind of plays out like a visual novel in a way. Not in the traditional like anime visual novel sense, but a little more like a visual comic. You have your main character who wants to be a hero, but he has some questionable decision-making skills, and that basically boils down to you making questionable decisions on his behalf. you have the option when you first arrive at this castle to either go through the front gates or go through a window. And whichever one you choose is sure to set you off on a path of running into an insane amount of unusual circumstances, many of which will kill you in hilariously awful ways. And I think that was the biggest charm in the game, was just seeing how many fucked up ways you could die. I didn't care about the hero because I kind of thought he was a little more of like an anti-hero. And so I was just constantly looking for situations to put him in that were a little fucked up. And the game was more than happy to oblige me with fucked up scenarios. I think if I'm not mistaken, there was something like 178 different scenes.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's insane. The options that you have as you're going through this castle. There's an actual map of the castle, and people have mapped out how which choice you decide, which choice you make in the story determines the path you take through the castle and where you can possibly end up. The level of detail that's gone into a game that is essentially a point-and-click visual novel is insane, and I am 100% on board with it. I do have one gripe.
Okay.
And that is, it's a fair one, I think. When you're given the actual story, it shows up at the bottom, very visual novel style, in a box at the bottom. And you can see, it'll tell you, like, you know, you've walked into a room, there's some skeletons. It reminds me a lot of the text-based games I played as a kid. Before I even had a computer, I played that shit on a word processor. Green screen and all. It'll give you options like, you know, it'll describe the situation. So your heroes walked into a room. There's an army of skeletons staring back at you. They're stunned for a moment at your presence. What are you gonna do? I sat forever on the first screen, confused as fuck as what my options were, because there were three buttons at the top, and they were labeled 1, 2, and 3. And I had no idea what they meant. Zip, silch, none. There were no context clues, nothing. Couldn't see what they were supposed to mean on the screen. I could see the text box and I knew what the text box said. But what I didn't realize is that I needed to pull down on the right thumbstick, because what the numbers were just scrolled down. And so the box wasn't big enough to show it all, but where it cut off didn't give me an indication or an arrow or anything that I needed to scroll down. Such a stupid mistake. It's such an odd thing to get hung up on and just be sitting there going, what? What the fuck am I supposed to do here? You know? Because you know that the game isn't complicated, but yet you're very stuck. And you're like, I don't know what I'm supposed to
do. Am I broken?
I was very broken. And I like my first whole run through, I was just randomly choosing the numbers. I didn't even know what they meant. I just wanted to see what happened until I finally got to one scene where it was a very short text box and I could see the options underneath. And I went, oh my God, I'm an idiot. But there's no indication that you need to scroll down to see more. And that's partly my fault, but also a lot more partly the dev's fault. Some kind of indicator as to, hey, there's more information down here, dumbass, would be really useful. Yeah. It would also, another option maybe for it would be if when you're hovered over 1, 2, or 3, maybe pop up a small, like, transparent-ish kind of dialogue box that gives a detail as to what it's for, because the options are usually very short and sweet. They're not long detailed explanations, and so it wouldn't be too hard to fit, you know, attack into a small box so that when you're hovering over one, you know that one is attack. There's just a little bit better of a way that it could have been done. Once you figure it out, once you get the hang of it, it's fine. But I did find myself a lot still trying to, like, thinking I was highlighting 3, but I was really highlighting 1. And it could go with a little more enhancement as to, hey, dumbass, you picked this one. The icon that you click on, it does change a little when you're hovered over it, but it took a couple of runs before I started to really, like, commit that tiny difference enough to memory to be like, oh no, I'm hovered over 2 and I need to be on 3. It's just more of a quality of life thing than anything else that would just make the game a little easier to get through. Beyond that, you're going to run into some wild-ass characters. I already mentioned an army of ghostly skeletons. One of my favorites was that if you end up in these busted out tunnels under an old aquarium, there's a shark in the water, and your option is to run or fight the shark. If you fight the shark, it's going to get the upper hand on you until you have two options. Let it kill you, or throw a dress at it to distract it. Let me tell you something. Throw the dress at the shark. Okay? The options are always, when you're in a fight, it's always one option seems really fucking obvious. Like, yeah, just stab the shark, right? Stabbing the shark will get you killed every time. The obvious answer is the path to death. I guarantee it. And then the insane wild solution, like throw a pink dress at a shark, is the one that will save you and get you to the next level.
Nice.
It's so weird. And it took me so long to just accept that that was the reality of the game. And then once I finally did, I started getting a little farther.
Because
I was constantly dying. You can get killed three times before it makes you start the whole thing over. So you have three hearts. If you get fucked up, you get set back, and you get to try it again. Sometimes, depending on the choices you've made before, the obvious solution is actually the path, but 90% of the time, it's going to be something wild ass out of left field that works the best. And that's the actual charm of the game and where I really started to love it more. I still hate the hero. He's an ass. He's an anti-hero in my book. But I started to just love the way that the game was like, that doesn't really seem like a solution now, does it? And then you do it and it works.
Oh, Lord. Well, overall,
one more thing before you cut me off.
I thought this was going to be a short review, and this is like one of the longer ones on the episode.
Doing my best. Hold on. I got one more thing. There are three different ways to end the game. Not three different endings, but three different ways. Because the path you set your hero on, asshole that he may be, determines the kind of hero and the kind of ending he gets. There are a couple different endings per hero type, but the best part of it is he gets three possible paths. He can either be a hero, he can be a killer, or he can be a coward. And I implore you, if you try this game, try the coward path first, because it's the best.
Okay, well, don't tell us why. Don't give
anything
away. No,
I'm not going to. I'm done right there. Now, Okay. Ask me how I feel about the game.
All right, $5, your verdict.
This was a surprising buy it. I thought I was going to roll into it with a fuck it, why not? But there's so much effort gone into making this story just a quack fest that I'm just like, fuck, this was wonderful. Just buy it.
Nice.
Yeah.
And I think it's on sale for $4 right now, so jump on it while it's cheap.
Even better.
Yeah.
Although I would recommend a guide for the completion.
I probably won't worry about it. I'll just play the game.
There's a lot of paths. I even recommend a guide just for the sake of actually getting to see everything.
Like the shark in a dress.
Like the shark with the dress. There.
Well, that is it for this episode. We made it through another one.
Huzzah,
indeed. Pernell, are you still drunk?
I'm never going to stop being drunk. Are you kidding me? drunk like a fishy fish.
I hope you clip that.
Well, it's on the episode, so someone else could clip it. I'm too lazy to do it myself. But another thanks to AJ at Dalala Studios for coming on chatting with us. Battletoads is available now on Xbox One, Windows 10, and on Steam, so give that a go. Give it a try. Relive your childhood and play the game that AJ wanted to make. I'm always happy when a developer is like, yeah, I got to make the game I wanted to make.
Yeah.
That's just cool to hear. But
yes, it is.
All right. That is it for this episode. Anyone have any final words before we get to some baller ass Battletoads music?
Battletoads, no!
I just wanted to read a tweet that I just came across.
Okay.
In reference to the debate tonight, Jeremy Slater tweeted, "That was the worst thing I've ever seen, and I wrote Fantastic Four."